My name is Jerry Root, and I teach at Wheaton College in Wheaton, Illinois. It's like a university. And I also teach at Biola University and Talbot Graduate School of Theology. A little background on my own interest in C.S. Lewis. I was a university student, and in my first year, I became a Christian. And I was very enthusiastic about the fact that God loved me and forgave me. So I started sharing Christ with my friends. And they would ask questions, and I didn't know the answers to the questions. I'll tell more about that later. So I would look up for answers, and I would find C.S. Lewis's name often showing up in the literature. And then my junior year, my third year of university, I was visiting with my sister, and she was teaching children in school. And she was reading to them the Narnian Chronicles. And she told me the plot of The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe. And it sounded very interesting to me. So I bought a set of those books. And I read them. And I liked them very much. And I wanted to find out more about C.S. Lewis. So I went and read his autobiography, Surprised by Joy. And that book touched me deeply. Because he kept talking about these longings in his heart. And wondering what was the object of the longing. And I understood what he was writing about because I knew those longings in my heart as well. So I was hooked onto Lewis by that time, by that autobiography. And I started reading everything I could get my hands on that he wrote. There's actually 74 books in all. He wrote 56 during his lifetime and he wrote the others after he died. No, actually, they're collections of letters that he wrote. And there's also essays that were brought together under common cover. When I finished college, a person said to me wisely, "You do not get an education in university. You only lay a foundation for an education. And if you're going to get an education, you have to build on that foundation and commence your education after you finish college. So pick an author who will take you places and make that author your life's study." I don't think it has to be an author. It could be a composer. It could be an artist. It could be a period of history, a country, something like that. But something that keeps you engaged and growing. Well, I picked C.S. Lewis. And he opens up more than just wardrobe doors. He opens up a world of literature to us. So I would read his books, and then beyond that, I would read the books that he would refer to. And I found myself growing, and so on. I went to graduate school and seminary. And I knew that I had to write a thesis for my master's degree in seminary. And I knew that I wasn't going to be able to write it on the use of the optative mood in the Greek text of Philemon. So instead, I wrote my thesis on C.S. Lewis. The result of that was eventually I started teaching college and university courses on Lewis. And then later went on and did my doctorate, and did my doctorate also on C.S. Lewis. And I've published several books on him now, and I've been teaching on C.S. Lewis for 32 years, and have lectured about him on 52 universities in 11 different countries. So it's been a lifelong interest of mine. But nevertheless, as I give you that just as background, I recognize that other people maybe aren't as enthusiastic about Lewis. I feel like a man who, when he was a boy, maybe saw a beetle on a leaf in a back garden, liked the way the light was glistening on the wings of the beetle, so he got out his books and started reading the books to find out about the name of the beetle, its lifestyle, and its habitat, and so on. And finally, he started studying the beetle for years and years, and then eventually found out everybody wanted to know about the beetle. C.S. Lewis is my beetle on the back leaf in the garden. And if nobody was interested in him at all, I would still be interested. I'm so fascinated, not just by what he wrote, but by the books in that he leads you to. For example, he wrote one book called English Literature in the 16th Century, Excluding Drama. The book is about 700 pages long, one of the 74 books. To write that book, he read every book written in English in the 16th century. He read every book translated into English in the original language it was written, Latin, Old Italian, Old French, and in the original, I mean, in the English translation, so that he could compare the translations and make judgments about them. It's a prodigious work of literature. You can't read him for long where you won't want to read Homer. He led me to Homer. He'll lead you to the Greek playwrights, Aeschylus, Sophocles, Euripides, and so on. You'll want to read Plato and Aristotle, of course, and you'll want to read Cicero, and you'll want to read Boethius's The Consolation of Philosophy, and Lewis's book, The Discarded Image on the Medieval Worldview. He says the most influential book in medieval literature after the Bible was Boethius's The Consolation of Philosophy. He gives 16 pages discussion of that book in that particular of Boethius in his book, The Discarded Image. He said up till 200 years ago, a person wasn't considered educated if they didn't know that book. I'd never heard of it before. I go to the bookstore, I say, do you have Boethius? And they say, oh yeah, it's right here. It was written in 524 AD. Who's writing today that 1500 years from now their books will still be on the shelf? I read Boethius and it took my breath away. And I have had a love affair with Boethius for ages because of this. But I wouldn't have gotten to that book had it not been for Lewis. And then, of course, you'd have to read Dante. He had a great love for Dante. He thought he was the greatest poet. So reading Dante, Chaucer. In America, we read a couple of the Chaucer's Canterbury Tales, but usually the most bawdy and most disrespectful ones, The Miller's Tale, The Wife of Bath's Tale. But we don't read the spiritually serious ones. They wouldn't have us read those in American schools. But Lewis writes about, in The Allegory of Love, Chaucer's Troilus and Cressida. So I pick up this book. I have to read it after the things that Lewis said about it. I remember finishing it the first time on an airplane. And I was so moved by the story, I just started weeping. And I scrunched down in my seat in the airplane. I wasn't so much afraid of the tears. It was more if somebody asked me about the world where I had been living for the last 2 or 3 weeks reading this story, I knew I wouldn't be able to do justice to the story. It was so moving. And Lewis helped me with that. You'll want to read Milton. You'll want to read, of course, the metaphysical poets, George Herbert, John Donne, Thomas Traherne. He'll lead you also to his contemporaries and near contemporaries, George MacDonald, G.K. Chesterton, J.R.R. Tolkien, Charles Williams. These people were in this literary group with him, the Inklings, and so on. And I think that Lewis is going to be an author who, if you read him, he won't leave you in a rut. He's always leading you on and nudging you on in exciting and wonderful ways. And he will be the source of a liberal arts education, basically, as you read him. And that was my experience. So that's just background. Now, in this particular forum, the question that was posed for this seminar, pre-forum seminar, is if C.S. Lewis were here today, what would he say? And I have to say that I don't think there's anybody that can answer that question. You'd have to have omniscience in order to do this. But instead, playing it safe, I will modify the discussion and ask, what did Lewis say during his lifetime that still has relevance for today? And I think that might be a better way to look at it. And though there are many, many things that he said that would have great relevance, I can only be selective. We'll just take a few because we would be going on for days otherwise. And he said something too is relative to relevance for today. He talks in a literary critical book called A Preface to Paradise Lost. It's a book he wrote for those who want to study Milton's Paradise Lost. There's a chapter in there called The Doctrine of the Unchanging Human Heart. And Lewis said, if we look throughout time, we see that there are common features that people have, common characteristics that transcend time, that transcend place, that transcends even culture, and so on. The doctrine of the unchanging human heart. Examples of this might be G.K. Chesterton, when he wrote The Everlasting Man, he's talking about prehistoric man. He says, what do we really know about prehistoric man? And Chesterton said he didn't leave us a written record. So the only thing we really know about prehistoric man is that he was an artist. He painted pictures on the walls of caves. Well, if he was an artist, he wasn't a whole lot different than us. That's interesting to me. We see a commonality that transcends time, from us in this moment to prehistoric man painting pictures on caves. We don't know why he painted the pictures. Was he painting the pictures because they were iconography for worship? Was he painting pictures because it was the man cave and the men would come and prepare themselves for a big hunt or celebrate the victories that they had had when they came back with food for their village? Or was it a cave where they had pictures on the wall and it was sort of a communal nursery while everybody else was out hunting and gathering and surviving? They would let the children be taken care of in that cave. We have no idea. All we know is that he was an artist. So he wasn't that much different than us. There was a French pantomime artist. His name was Marcel Marceau. He would remove language from his presentations. And with pantomime, he would communicate by motion and by gesture. He would communicate in a way that whether a person was in an Occidental Western culture or an Oriental Eastern culture, people could still catch what he was saying. Because he would talk about features of the heart and what it was to be human in a broken world and so on. And he could bring laughter and a tear. I saw him perform. It was amazing. Eliminating the particulars of language, he got to that which was common. Or another example would be Shakespeare. When I was a boy, Shakespeare was always performed in costuming from the Elizabethan age out of which he wrote. But about maybe 35, 40 years ago, Shakespeare started being performed in costumes from every different age and from every different culture. And what they were trying to say by that is that Shakespeare is speaking about common human things, and consequently, he's always relevant. So it doesn't make any difference what period or time. He's always contemporary. You look at the tragedies. The tragedies begin with some misunderstanding, and somebody is disappointed. And they project the disappointment on the person who said the incautious word. And the anger is held, and it turns into bitterness. And at the end of the tragedy, the whole stage is strewn with dead bodies. And the comedies begin the same way. Somebody says something, somebody's upset. But at the end of the comedy, everybody gets laughter at their own expense because they don't take themselves as seriously. These are common things. Well, when Lewis says that he believed in the doctrine of the unchanging human heart, that people could be so similar from age to age and culture to culture, he said he didn't believe any longer that that was the defining characteristic. Because he believed that with that common thread that runs through all ages, he sees great elasticity in human nature. We can be so different from culture to culture and age to age. Our music changes. Our style of clothes changes. Our histories have revealed that different people have asked different questions, and those questions have shaped how they respond to the circumstances in their world. And so Lewis says if you really want to talk about what's human, you can talk about the common things, but you need to be sensitive to the things that divide us or separate us or particularize us to time and place and culture. That's the best way to go, he says. He says even, if you think you need notes when you read a book by the 17th century author John Milton, imagine the notes that Milton would need if he rose from the dead and showed up and was going to read a modern novel. What's a toaster? What's an automobile? What's a DVD? What's a GameCube? What's an iPad? You know, and it's an automobile. You can see how it would be. Well, if he would need those notes to read a modern novel, we would have to imagine that then those changes would require that we would have something similar when reading a novel that he had written in his time. People change. We want to be sensitive to that. But nevertheless, I think that we can still talk about what did Lewis write that has relevance for us today. And there are many things, and we'll focus on those. But also, I would like to say another preliminary. There'll be a few preliminaries I'm going to say here before we get into our first big point, which would be a discussion of the abolition of man by C.S. Lewis. But I need to say a few more preliminary things. First off, I need to say that, bottom line, the seminar is not ultimately about Lewis. There will be a lot of Lewis, and we'll hear a lot about him and his point of view. But ultimately, I would like to suggest to you this seminar is about something else, ultimately. I think I could put it in context. All of my life, even though I wasn't very academically inclined as a boy, all of my life I've had a love affair with words. I remember the first time I ever fell in love with a word. It was in my first grade class. And Mrs. Reinhart was our teacher. And she would help us build our vocabulary by going through flashcards. And every day we would have to go through flashcards to see the words and to learn how to pronounce them and to learn what they meant. We would sit in a small circle around her. And I fell in love with one word at that time. It was the word swish. I still love that onomatopoeic word. I have loved it long before it was popularized by a clean shot in basketball. You know, if the ball goes right through the basket, they say it was a swish shot, that sort of thing. And I thought that it was a good day if sitting in that circle when Mrs. Reinhart was going through the cards, if I got to say swish. Pokey was another word I liked at that time. I can still see the clothes people were wearing and the environment when I learned words like ambiguity, perplexed, subtle. These are words I love. Even the word ostentatious, which is a word too ostentatious for my vocabulary. It's another word. But there's one word I have in mind that might help us understand where I would like to go with the seminar ultimately. When I was in the third grade, my third year of school as a child, we were very poor, and I grew up in South Central Los Angeles. And I would see children at our school, and they would have money to go into the cafeteria to eat lunch. It cost 31 cents, so a third of a dollar. We didn't have enough money to pay for that lunch. My mother would make us a lunch. I would take it to school, a sandwich, a cookie, and a piece of fruit. But I would see my friends going into the cafeteria, and I always wondered, what was that like? What did they get to do that I didn't get to do? And one day, my mother, to my surprise, as I left home, handed me 31 cents as I went out the door. And I put it in my pocket, and I was afraid that I might lose it before lunchtime. So I was always checking my pocket to make sure it was still in there. But as I went into the cafeteria then that day for lunch, I was nervous. I wouldn't have been able to describe it like this then, but the feelings were there. That unfamiliar with the sociological protocols of elementary school cafeteria life, would I do something foolish and the other children would laugh at me as a result? So I watched with intensity the girl in front of me, and anything she did, I did to make sure I didn't do something that was contrary to the cultural norms. She gave the woman at the cash register her money. I did the same thing and was relieved to know that I had gotten those 31 cents to that woman. Then she grabbed her fiberglass tray and her knife and fork and spoon, and I did the same. Then she put the tray on that chrome roll bar counter. Do you remember that thing? And she started sliding it across, and there were the first things on the menu, and it was string beans. I hated string beans. I don't think I love them any better now than I did then. And apparently this girl didn't like them either, because she said to the cafeteria lady, "I'll have a small portion of those, please." I had never heard the word portion before, but I watched as a cafeteria lady. Do you remember her? She was sort of a heavy-set woman. She had gray hair, and it was in a hairnet, and she had a white outfit on and a white apron with smudge marks on it. And she worked, I think, in every elementary school cafeteria in the world, that lady. She was ubiquitous. Okay, so she grabs a big spoon with holes in it so that the juices can go through. And she digs down into this pot, and she pulls out three string beans and puts them in a little bowl and hands them to that girl. So I said to the cafeteria lady, "I'll have a small portion of those too, please." And she did the same thing for me. I'd never heard this word before. So I moved down the cafeteria line, put other things on my tray. I get to the end of the line. Remember what was at the end of the line? The desserts. And I wondered if this word maybe had other applications, because I saw the most economically cut pieces of chocolate cake I'd seen in my life. And so I said to the cafeteria lady, "I'll have a large portion of that, please." And she cut me the biggest piece of chocolate cake I'd ever seen in my life. And I thought, that's a good word. That's really a good word. Well, the psalmist says, "Whom have I in heaven but thee? And besides thee, I desire nothing on earth. My heart and my flesh may fail, but God is the strength of my heart and my portion forever. My concern is that each of us sitting in this seminar will come away saying, Lewis is interesting, but I feel like I got a larger portion of God. I feel like I understood things about him I never understood before. I feel like I fell in love with him more deeply than I ever felt in love with him before. C.S. Lewis said, when you look at an author, the issue is not about the author. The issue is about seeing what the author sees. Matter of fact, if you look through the eyes of an author, when you read a book, technically you're looking through his eyes. The only person you can't see when looking through the eyes of another is that person. Lewis says, we need to use authors as spectacles, glasses, not make a spectacle of the author. We don't want to leave here impressed with Lewis, so I think we will be impressed with him. Our goal is to see what he sees, and Lewis's focus is clear. He is a man in love with God. He is a man who's been able to integrate his faith into his learning and into his life. And he helps those who read him well to see in that way. To me, this is important. And it's in light of that, too, that I have then two more preliminaries before we actually get into the text per se that I have prepared for you. Lewis was giving a lecture at Oxford University to his to the students, the English students at Oxford University. And in this lecture called The English Syllabus, he said, we have fulfilled our whole responsibility to you. And our whole function to you, if we can help you to see some given tract of reality. We can help you see something that is different than yourself. Lewis was an objectivist. I'll develop this more. Something very important that we need to say to today. Something Lewis said long ago that still is extremely relevant to today. Lewis was an objectivist. That is, he believed there was an objective reality that existed independent of our independent of us, and independent of our thinking about it. And then there are people who are knowers, who can know that reality. There are subjects and objects. And what we think about reality is, if we think accurately about it, is truth. Truth is not reality. Truth is what I think about reality when I think accurately about it. So it's when the subjective apprehension is in accord with the objective reality. This was a dominant feature in Lewis. It was something that was important to him before he was a Christian. It was something that I think had a hand in leading him to faith also. And it was something that he underscored particularly. All of his evil characters in his fiction, from his pre-Christian Dimer, all the way through The Great Divorce, written in the 40s, Dimer written in the 20s, Pilgrim's Regress even, written in the 30s, Great Divorce written in the 40s, his science fiction written in the 40s, and his Narnian Chronicles written in the 50s. All across four decades, all of his evil characters are what he calls subjectivists. They are people who no longer take their lead from the objective reality and consequently project on reality what they want it to be. And they try to manipulate reality, as opposed to letting reality be what it is and adjusting the scoliosis. Do you know the word scoliosis? Scoliosis is if you have curvature of the spine. Or we could talk then about scoliosis of our reason, scoliosis of our moral life, scoliosis of our emotional life. Lewis believed that we had to adjust the scoliosis of our soul to the plumb line of reality, whether it be the objective reality that we meet in the world or the reality that we encounter by means of definition and inferential reasoning and conclusions that we can develop that way. So Lewis says to his students, we have fulfilled our whole duty to you. If we could help you, in a sense, break out of the self-centeredness and subjectivism and help you to see some tract of reality and then from there grow and develop, both in your understanding and also in how you adjust your moral life to that understanding. It's very powerful, I think. And I think because Lewis infused his faith in this whole process, because he believed that the real world was a world inhabited by God. Lewis says, God walks everywhere incognito. That every bush is a burning bush, and the world is crowded with God. Our responsibility is to awaken to Him, and even more, to remain awake to Him. So, there's the last book he wrote before he died was Letters to Malcolm, chiefly on prayer. It was a sequel, in a sense, to Screwtape Letters. Screwtape Letters was one devil writing to another devil on how to tempt somebody. Lewis was going to write a sequel, one angel writing to another angel on how to encourage somebody. But Lewis said, who could ever write the second book? All of us are always closer to the diabolical than we are to the divine. So the sequel is instead one human being writing to another human being as they struggle along, his best impressions of the spiritual life as he can configure it. And in this Letters to Malcolm, he's still talking about this idea, I want you to see some given tract of reality. And he talks about reality as if it is infused with the presence of God. There's a word that he uses. I'm going to give you a quote from that book. I think it's one of the best things he wrote. But before I give you the quote, there's a word I want to define for you. And I don't define it to insult your intelligence. You may already know the word. But when I first read this passage in 1979 or whenever it was, maybe 1980, I had no clue what this word meant. But the word is coruscation. Coruscation. And a coruscation is a sudden flash of brightness. If we look westward in a storm coming our way, we might see lightning flashing in the dark clouds, and we could say the lightning was coruscating in the storm clouds. Or where I live in the Midwest, we have fireflies or lightning bugs. And we could talk about fireflies coruscating in the back garden on a humid summer evening. Have you seen fireflies, you guys? They're the most magnificent things. Anyway, so you get the idea of the word, some sort of flash like that. And Lewis is in this quote, where, again, we're going to see reality infused with the presence of God. In this particular quote, he's making a distinction between gratitude and adoration or worship. He says, gratitude exclaims very properly, how good of God to give me this. But adoration asks, what must that being be like whose far off and momentary coruscations are like this? One's mind runs back up the sunbeam to the sun. I read that. What must this being be like? What must God be like? I read that, like I said, about 1979 or 1980. And it was when Voyager, the interplanetary probe, was speeding past Saturn, taking pictures of that most mysterious planet in our solar system, the planet with rings. And they discovered at that moment that the outer ring of Saturn, it's called the F ring, is braided. It's braided. And I caught myself, just having read Lewis, what must God be like? Though no human eye had ever seen it, he had chosen to braid the outer ring of Saturn. I live in an academic environment. I have friends who are physicists. I say, why is it braided? I've heard five different answers, and each answer stands in negation to the other four. I think one day the physicists are going to tell us why it's braided. But in the meantime, I say, wow, what must God be like, you see? I shared this with a friend of mine, too, and he said, yeah, and we don't know, Jerry, if God didn't just braid it for the picture, like people do with little girls' hair, you know. I think a fish in the bowels of the ocean, where some ship will be parked over the Pacific Ocean, greater than the light of the sun can reach, and they'll dangle cameras down into those dark, dark depths, and they'll take pictures of fish painted neon bright. Why? Why are fish painted that color? It can't be to attract a mate. There's no sight down there. As a matter of fact, how do fish at those depths even get together to propagate themselves? That itself, to me, is interesting. But what must God be like that He painted fish neon bright in the bowels of the ocean? I'll tell you another one aside. Do any of you ever get to Bulgaria? There's a guy in Sofia. His name is Bob Faber. Do you know him? Do you get to Bulgaria?
I come from there, but I do not know him.
You don't know him. Are you from Sofia?
Not really.
Uh-huh.
I grew up there, but I moved out when I was 15, before I became a Christian.
Yes. Well, there's a guy here, Nick Nedelcheff. Uh-huh. He has a seminary there, and Bob teaches at that seminary. But Bob was a guy who was a chief operating officer of one of the dot-com companies in the 90s. He became very, very wealthy, and he was very, very successful. He was a man of great character, is a man of great character. I remember in those days when he was flourishing in business, his one-and-a-half-year-old drowned. And he called me and he said, "Jerry, how quickly can you get here? My son William has drowned." I said, "I'll be on the next plane, Bob." He had two older children. And I was with Bob and Becky, walking them through those days, and I preached a funeral for William and so on. I said, "Bob, you know, at the funeral, don't be surprised if somebody says something stupid or incautious to you. As a matter of fact, don't be surprised if somebody says, 'Bob, I know exactly how you feel. I had a dog die once.'" I said, "People can say silly things like that. It's because nobody's really very life skilled when it comes to how do you talk with somebody when their child just died." Sure enough, the funeral's over. I'm talking to somebody, Bob standing right about here, and I hear this woman say, "Oh, Bob, I know just how you feel. I had a dog die once." And I looked over there. And Bob took both of his hands and took her hand and looked her in the eye. And through his tears, he said to her, "Thank you for being here with us today. Thank you for coming and being with us in the midst of our pain." He did not judge her for an incautious remark. He heard beyond it a well-intended statement, incautiously stated from a woman who was there. Well, Bob, one day he decided to leave business. He had saved enough money that he could have supported his family for three generations on the mission field by the amount of money he made. And one day he was at the grad school and he said, "Hey, Jerry, I want you to come to my house and see something." And he took me to his house and he showed me this gem collection he had amassed, with pictures of, I mean, he had in these museum drawers, all made by carpentry, these beautiful stones. He says, "Yeah, for example, this stone, the other half of this stone is in the British Museum in London. And this stone is this unique thing, and this stone is that unique thing." I said, "Bob, how'd you get interested in all of this?" He said, "When I was a boy, 8 years old, my uncle brought me a crystal, and it was yellow. And I said, 'Why is it yellow?' And his uncle said, 'Because water leaches through the stones and caves, and that water starts to crystallize. And if there's sulfur in there, it will get in the water and it will crystallize yellow. And there are some with copper that will crystallize green, or some with different forms of iron and lead and so on.'" And he was showing me examples of these colors. And he said, "The whole earth is pocked with things as small as the inside of a geode stone and as large as a cave. And there's color running all through it. And though no human eye has ever gotten to those dark places, God has chosen to put color there." And I go, "Wow, what must God be like? Same idea." Well, it ended up that when the dot-coms went south and all of Bob's stocks were in dot-coms, he lost everything. Everything. I had said to him when I saw his gem collection, "Bob, your gem collection looks like it might rival the gem collection at the Chicago Natural History Museum." And he says, "Oh, no, 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 my collection is much better than the one they have there." But he lost everything. So now he could leave the mission field. He had gone to Bulgaria by that time, learned Bulgaria as a language. He could leave the mission field and go back to business and earn the money all over again. Or he could liquidate everything he had, and Bob sold that entire gem collection so that he could stay in Bulgaria and love on the people. What must God be like that he made people like Bob Faber? He left to go back to Bulgaria. I said, "Bob, did you keep any of the stones?" He says, "Just that little crystal that my uncle gave me when I was 8 years old." And 3 days after he left, his sister came to my office and said, "Before Bob left, he wanted me to give you this. And it was a crystal, and I have it on my bookshelf in my office to remind me that there are things in reality that God wants us to attend to, as Lewis reminded us, that will lift our hearts up in worship. I grew up in Southern California. I love to see palm trees silhouetted against an auburn sunset sky, or mountain ranges. Now I live in the Midwest, where it is as flat as a pancake, and I like to see cornfields silhouetted against an auburn sunset sky. There's beauty there if you would distill it out. There's beauty there. But we could have lived on a darkened planet, and we could have gotten word from on high there would be one sunset. And we could have lined every west coast of every continent and every island on our globe and regaled our progeny by writing of that great event in our diaries and journals. But what must God be like that He has made our planet a perpetual kaleidoscope of sunrises and sunsets? Wow! If you look up at the night sky, if there was only one star twinkling in the night sky, that alone should be enough to awaken wonder and awe in the heart and mind of every right-feeling and right-thinking individual. But what must God be like that He has glittered the night sky with stars and moons and shooting stars and suns and galaxies? And oh, I wish you could have been with me when I was up by Lake Superior, where Wheaton College, where I teach, has a campus. I was teaching there one summer, and the students came knocking on my door at midnight, and they said, "Jerry, they're out, they're out." And I came out of the cabin where I was staying, and I looked up, and it was the Northern Lights in whites and blues and greens and reds, just pulsating and coruscating in the night sky. And we went out on the ski dock, and we did the only thing that it seemed appropriate to do at that moment. We sang songs of worship and praise till 2:30 in the morning. Wow! What must God be like? Lewis calls our attention to these things. What must He be like that He made delicate things? Like butterflies, flower petals, hummingbirds, and peacock feathers. Oh my heavens! G.K. Chesterton said, "One elephant with a trunk looked odd, but every elephant with a trunk looked like a plot." God is calling us to attend to Him. But the great thing about Lewis, He won't let us stop there. This is too easy. Lewis forces us to also ask questions like this. What must God be like that there are AIDS babies born in Africa? What must God be like that there are earthquakes in Haiti, tsunamis in Japan? And we've got to incline ourselves towards those things too. In his sermon, The Weight of Glory, Lewis says, if our religion is something objective, there it is again. If our religion is something objective, then we should never divert our eyes from those elements in it which seem puzzling or repellent. For it's precisely the puzzling and the repellent which reveal what we do not yet know and need to know so desperately. When I hear these debates between Christians and atheists, I always break my heart about the atheists, because I always feel like they bailed too early. They didn't stay inclined to look at it a little deeper. You know, and my heart breaks them. I don't get mad at them or anything. I just think that there must have been some sadness that they engage with. But unlike Lewis, who stays inclined to the puzzling and repellent, they bailed and they didn't look more deeply. Okay, so this thing about reality is really important for us. Lewis reminds us of these things, but he also makes it clear, an important preliminary before we look at the abolition of man, that reality is what he says, iconoclastic. Reality is iconoclastic. An iconoclast is a person who breaks idols. I have an idea of God. I hear a sermon. I read a book. I have a late night conversation with friends. That image of God that's so helpful at that moment when pieces of the puzzle come together for me. If I hold on to that present understanding too tightly, it will begin to compete against my having a growing understanding of God. So consequently, the image once helpful now has become an idol. Reality is iconoclastic. The world in which God has placed us, in the world infused with His presence, in the world that displays His glory. Calvin said, creation, God dons the garment of creation. Or as the scriptures say, the heavens declare the glory of God. The earth showeth His handiwork. or as Paul said in Romans 1, that which is known about God is evident to them, for God made it evident. For since the beginning of creation, His divine nature and invisible attributes are clearly seen in what is made, so that we're without excuse. So God has displayed Himself in this world that He has made. And the things that He's displayed, as we grasp them, none of them are complete. C.S. Lewis says several places, I want God, not my idea of God. I want my neighbor, not my idea of my neighbor. I want my spouse, not my idea of my spouse. I want myself, not my idea of myself. We constantly have false notions that need to be renegotiated. The pain of this renegotiation will be dependent upon how tightly we've held on to the once helpful notion, but forgot that it was something that is developing and should be growing. How many of you have read the Narnian books by C.S. Lewis? Okay, the first one that he wrote was The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe. And in that book, we meet this young girl named Lucy. And she is the most spiritually sensitive of all the children that go into Narnia. When she goes back on the second trip into Narnia, it's called Prince Caspian. And in Prince Caspian, she sees Aslan for the first time, the Christ figure, the lion. She sees him for the first time on that second trip into Narnia. And she exclaims when she sees him, Aslan, you're bigger. He says, oh, no, child, I am not. But every year you grow, you will find me bigger. This is the idea. Reality is iconoclastic. This is the thing that should take our breath away. By the way, Lewis says that God cares nothing about temples built, only about temples building. In other words, reality is iconoclastic means God's always kicking out the walls of temples we build for Him because He wants to give us more of Himself. This is really good information for theologians or young theologians. Why is it? Because all theology is merely approximation. And the reality we seek to describe is bigger than the best we've ever thought of it. And consequently, we have to continue to do this revision. I would suggest to you that you do not get a last word about anything, let alone about God. Don't go into existential despair when I say that, because some of my students often do. Realize this, you don't get a last word about God, but that doesn't mean you can't have a sure word about God. C.S. Lewis said, just because the tree adds more rings, it doesn't have to discard the interior rings. Our thought, though, about God should be a dynamic thought. God is not dynamic. He's infinite. He's not going to grow. He's not going to change. He's immutable. But our thoughts to keep up with a human understanding of something so big needs to be dynamic. So consequently, bring on the curiosities. Ask the questions. I sometimes have students who are afraid to have doubts about their faith. I say, why are you afraid? Do you think you've achieved omniscience? Because if I don't have any doubts or any questions, I must have deluded myself into thinking I have achieved omniscience. Go ahead and ask the questions. Discover fresh answers. Let your heart explode in wonder and awe, because these are the prerequisites to real worship. Real worship. We call it orthodoxy, right? We use the word doxa or doxology to speak of worship. But doxa is a word that literally meant estimation. Orthos meant straight or right. We talk about an orthodontist who straightens teeth, an orthopedic surgeon who straightens arms. A straight estimation, orthodoxy of God, is one that is a dynamic understanding of God. And we use the word then, if I'm having a growing understanding of God, if I'm orthodox, then it should lead to doxa, worship, doxology, you see. And consequently, my heart keeps growing in that regard. Now, the idea in Lewis is not a new idea. It's an old idea. Others have talked about it. But we're going to take a break in a couple minutes. So before we do, maybe you have a question. We'll take a moment for questions. And then I'll develop this further second hour, and we'll get into the abolition of man. Any questions? Comments? It's too late for abridgments. We can't do anything about that. Okay. No questions? None? Do you have one? No? Okay. Then let's go on. When I say it's not a new idea to Lewis, there are others who have written about it. Baron von Hugel, an author Lewis refers to often enough, he is a philosopher of religion and spiritual director. Baron von Hugel had said in his letters to his niece, Gwendolyn Green, "Beware of the first clarity. Press on to the second clarity and the third clarity." You see, it's Lewis's heaven, right? Further up and further in. There's more. Another one would be Robert Browning, the British poet. He wrote a poem called Rabbi Ben Ezra. You should all write it down when you get married. How many of you are married? Any of you married? All of you are married. Write down this poem, Rabbi Ben Ezra. Google it. And you should, every year on your anniversary, read it to your spouse. It starts off, "Grow old along with me, the best is yet to be." And about line 20 or 30, no, about 20, 23, somewhere in there in that poem, Robert Browning makes this comment. "Welcome each rebuff, each difficulty, welcome the difficulties. Welcome each rebuff that turns earth's smoothness rough." We can think we have it all figured out. Our earth is nice and spherical and smooth, but the earth isn't spherical and smooth. The earth is textured. It's got peaks. It's got valleys. Welcome the things that help you to see it the way that it is rather than how you would have it be. So there's an example of reality as iconoclastic. Another one is Tennyson, the British poet. He wrote in his poem, In Memoriam, his best friend had died. He took 15 years writing this poem, working out his grief. His best friend was engaged to his sister. His sister never married. She never recovered from the grief. So in this poem, he says, "I sometimes hold it half a sin to put in words the grief I feel, for words like nature half reveal and half conceal the soul within." That everything we see about God, that he reveals about himself, even in his word, that there's something that's revealed and there's something concealed. The word revelation means to reveal. You've got it in Habakkuk chapter 3. It says, "In the display of God's glory, there was the hiding of his power." If God creates Mount Everest and we say, "Wow, he is powerful," it still doesn't show us the extent of his power. If he makes the Himalaya range, we say that's majestic and marvelous. It still doesn't show us the extent. If he speaks and a universe comes into being, it still doesn't show us the extent of his capacity. Every creative act is still the hiding of his power. You see, that's the idea. In that same poem, Tennyson wrote this. "Our little systems," talking about theological systems, "our little systems have their day, they have their day and cease to be. They are but broken lights of thee, and thou, O Lord, art more than they." The systems are good. They're sure words. They're just not last words. So they need to be supple words, not rigid words. The sure word is in the middle, but at the core, there should be a constant growing understanding, a dynamic understanding of God. And then another one is St. Augustine in the Confessions. He says, "The house of my soul is too small. Enlarge it, Lord, that you might enter in." It's the same idea. And then the last one, we have 2 minutes maybe left. And the last one that I would give you, it would be Stephen's defense in Acts 7. In Acts chapter 7, he is accused of speaking against the temple in Jerusalem. And he says in his defense, "Are you kidding me? You think you've got God in that little box up on the hill there? Don't you realize when God first appeared to our father Abraham, it was in Mesopotamia, hundreds and hundreds of miles from where that temple is. And when God first appeared to Joseph, even when Joseph was in Egypt, God was with him, hundreds and hundreds of miles from where this temple is. And when Moses led the children out of Egypt, or even before that, when Moses was living as a shepherd in the Midian wilderness, God appeared to him in a burning thorn bush. The flame in the bush, and the bush wasn't consumed. Hundreds and hundreds of miles from where this temple is. And even when David wanted to build the temple, God said to him, "Are you kidding me, David? Heaven is my throne. Earth is just my footstool. How will you, on that little tiny planet of yours, build a house big enough to contain me?" Reality is iconoclastic. There it is, right there in the scriptures, over and over. Okay, so our first session we covered preliminaries related to ideas in Lewis, as we focus on what would Lewis say if he were alive today. Nobody can answer that question, but we could say, what did Lewis say that is continually relevant? And I think one of the most important things that Lewis has said that speaks to our age is related to this idea of objectivity, an objectivity that is concerning itself with the understanding of reality. We must approach this with humility. We must also recognize that the reality that we know is complex, and we as knowers are limited. So consequently, reality is iconoclastic. I have heard preachers before who, holding up a Bible after a sermon, have said, I'm not telling you this, this is the Word of God. Have you ever heard that before in a sermon? Well, no, that's not true. They did tell me this. C.S. Lewis said, the worst of bad men are religious bad men. The quicker I might be willing to die for my faith, maybe the quicker I would be willing to kill for my faith. And the bad thing is when a religious person paints a thus saith the Lord across their own opinions. I believe in inerrancy. I am an inerrantist. I am very conservative in my understanding of the Word of God. I tease sometimes and I say, I don't believe the Bible's inspired word for word, an inerrant word for word. I don't hold to that liberal doctrine. Because Jesus said not a jot or a tittle would pass away. The jot is the smallest letter in the Hebrew alphabet, the yod. It's about the size of a comma in English punctuation. And the tittle was the smallest part of a letter, like the leg of an R or the tail of a Q. And Jesus said, not the smallest letter or the smallest particle of a letter will pass away. I am very conservative when it comes to the Scriptures. And yet, which Bible is inspired? Is it the pre-interpreted text or the post-interpreted text? And it seems to me it's pretty clear it's the pre-interpreted text, not the text that goes through my grid of interpretation. I may interpret it accurately. I may interpret it diligently. But my interpretation is not equal to the Word of God necessarily. So I have to be cautious, even the claims I make about the Bible. And I don't want to produce a bunch of people in my church who think that my theological take, whatever theological school I'm in, is the last word on Scripture. So if you don't see it the way I see it, something must be wrong with you, because I painted a thus saith the Lord across my opinion, like the prophets, the false prophets in Ezekiel, and were warned, beware of those who say, thus saith the Lord, when the Lord hath not said. I'll give you an example of this. I was giving a lecture in California. There were about 250 people there, and I was speaking on C.S. Lewis and postmodernism. I think more people talk about postmodernism than really read about it. And you read the people now who are on the cutting edge of the academic world, postmodernism is dying. Terry Eagleton said in his book After Theory, the reason why he thinks it's dying is because the first generation of postmodernist thinkers were perspectivalists, not relativists. The second generation became relativists, and he says that's why it was going to die. Because there's nothing more incongruous than a preaching relativist. What position do they come from, you see? So he said it's destined to die, and he says some really interesting things about where he thinks theory is going, literary theory is going, and so on. But nevertheless, you'll see people talking about postmodernism, and you hear the things they say, and you think, I don't think that they read anything about this. It's like the student who was once asked, have you ever read War and Peace? And he said, no, but I wrote a book report on it once. Well, we need to make sure as people in ministry that we're not preaching the Bible that way. Or we could become like Lewis's worst of bad men. Anyway, I was speaking at this gathering on Lewis and postmodernism, maybe just trying to keep myself gainfully employed because I've done all my academic work on Lewis. As long as his voice is still at play, then maybe I'll be relevant, you know. So it might have been self-serving. But in the middle of the lecture, this woman stands up and yells out in front of this group of 250 people, "We don't need any of this." And I didn't have any life experience with that sort of situation before. I didn't know what to do exactly. I operate with the belief that none of us is very life skilled. We're all relatively awkward. Nobody's ever ready to get married. If you waited till you were, you'd miss out on that great endeavor. Nobody's ever ready to have children. If you waited till you were, the whole human race would end this generation. And we operate awkwardly, right? A child learning to walk, a toddler falls down and gets bruised. A six-year-old taking the training wheels off of the two-wheel bike falls down and gets abrasions. You know, an adolescent picking up a skateboard for the first time, trying to ollie or take on a half pipe, sprains an ankle or breaks a wrist or something like that. All of us have these occasions that remind us that we operate at a level of awkwardness, and I don't know that I ever felt any more awkward than when this woman yelled up that we didn't need any of this, and I was just giving my lecture. I couldn't ignore her because she stood up and shouted it out. And so I just improvised what I should do. And I said to the woman, "Well, what's your point?" And she says, "We don't need any of this because we have the mind of Christ," she said. And I said, "Yes, it's true. The Bible says that. Do you know where it says it?" She didn't know the passage. I said, "It's in 1 Corinthians 2:16. And when it says we have the mind of Christ, if are you suggesting that we have the mind of Christ as an accomplished fact? As if somehow we've achieved omniscience? If that's the case, then why would Paul have chided the people at Corinth in chapter 1, the preceding chapter, by saying, you have divisions among you. Some say you're of Paul, some say you're of Apollos, some say you're of Peter, some say you're of Christ. Why do these divisions exist among you? If they had the mind of Christ as an accomplished fact, why was this going on? Or do you think Paul is saying, we have this great and valuable resource, the Word of God, which is reflective of the mind and heart of God. And with that, we have the responsibility to try to understand it as best we can. And this is important. Fortunately, she understood what I was saying. She sat down at least, and I was able to go on with the lecture. But I think this concept that we have to approach this objective world, we have to approach the objective revelation of God in Scripture with the degree of humility that we don't have it all figured out. We want to do it in community where love is in place so we can hear what others say. If they challenge what we've said, we're not taking offense to it. We assume that we probably got some things wrong somewhere. And so we can prune the branches in community, so that the dead branches are not given more energy than they need. And we can then give the energy to other things so that fruit can grow in us and so on. The humility is a huge, huge part of it. So anyway, it's in light of that Lewis wants us to get to the objective reality. It's relevant today as it was when he spoke. And he wants us to get to it with humility, adjusting the scoliosis of our souls, this plumb line. There's an American author, a British author named Anthony Trollope. He wrote in the Victorian era, and he wrote a book called Barchester Towers. And in that book, he said, only the preacher can compel people to sit still and be tortured. Now, we know that that's not true. We academics know that teachers can do it far better, because we teachers, you see, hold grades over students' heads, so we torture them beyond dessert and so on. But it does bring up a point, doesn't it? How do you persuade another person without manipulating them? All rhetoric is persuasion. I have a point of view, whether it be the political candidate I'd like you to vote for in the next election, or whether I want you to pass me the salt at the table. I want to persuade you to some sort of action, move you to some sort of action. How do we engage, especially in ministry, towards persuasion without coercion? Towards persuasion without manipulation? And Lewis seems to suggest that this is done by describing as best one might some slice of reality. If it is done well, the student becomes fascinated by the thing itself and less dependent upon the teacher. In other words, we get shoulder to shoulder with the person and describe this thing. And when they become interested in that, we can move away because they're going to stay interested in that. It's going to fascinate them. Lewis was an objectivist again. He believed in knowers and in things to be known. Lewis was no relativist. A truth claim necessitated some object, a material object or an object of thought. Again, defined, and then once defined, you can make inferences from that, always appealing back to the definition as kind of the plumb line or the foundation from which your thought is developed. He started the Oxford Socratic Club. And in the Oxford Socratic Club, he would have an atheist or a non-believer present a paper 1 week, and then the believers would debate with that person. The next week, a believer would present a paper, and the non-believers would debate against that person. And they would go on during term time, and they were very popular. And once there was a disputant who was there, and Lewis had delivered a paper, and the disputant got up and was deriding Lewis's view of reality, and he says, "How do you know there isn't a blue cow sitting on the piano right now?" And Lewis's answer was, "In what sense blue?" In other words, if you don't have anything to refer to, you can't make any judgments about the statement. Without an object, the debate about the blue cow is nonsense. And Lewis makes this statement. All judgments imply a standard. What's the standard? Either it's going to be self-referential and then utilitarian, using other people. Or it might be the collective standard, the majority and might begins to make right, and the minority is at the mercy of the majority, whether the majority is in the right or not. Or there's a transcendent standard that Lewis says in The Abolition of Man, overarchs rulers and ruled alike, whereby rulers' judgments can be tempered, and the obedience of servants and subjects and so on can be directed in a way that is proper and true. Truth is not reality, as I mentioned before. Truth is what I think about reality when I think accurately about it. Lewis wrote, "Truth is always about something, but reality is that about which truth is." Now, I'll give you an example. Two examples. I remember once I was in the building where I teach at Wheaton College, and I had to go to the restroom. And I went into one of the stalls in the restroom. So I was shut behind the door of the stall, and I heard somebody come into the restroom. And I finished up my business in the stall, and when I opened the door of the stall, I saw a woman standing at the mirror in the men's restroom, primping and putting on her lipstick or something. I don't know. She saw me in the mirror as I came out of the stall, and she turns towards me and starts berating me and screaming at me for being in the women's restroom. I won the debate with one word. Pointing, I said, "Urinals." And the woman screamed and ran out of the restroom. Now, there was an objective reality that confirmed my judgment. It settled the dispute, you see. That's the easiest way to do it. But we can't always refer to an object such as that. If it's an object of thought, it has to be a little different. So, for example, I had a student, and she was a Christian, and she said to me that she was going to bring her friend to class. Her friend was on spring break from her university. She went to Brown University, which is one of the Ivy League schools in America. It's one of the best schools in America. And her friend was an Ivy Leaguer, and she was going to bring her to class, and she said her friend was an atheist, they'd been friends since childhood, and she wanted to know if I would talk with her friend about Christ. I said I would be happy to talk with her. She comes to class, I meet her friend, and I say, "Tell me a little bit about yourself, tell me about your friendship, how did you two get to know each other? Well, you're going to Brown University, you must be very bright, my heavens, Ivy League school. What are you studying there?" She said, "Biochemistry." I said, "Man, you must be really bright, engaging in the sciences." I said, "Well, you sat through this class and we talked about theological themes, what do you think about a God?" And she said, "Well, as a biochemist..." Thought that was a little premature since she was only in her first year of university. But she says, "As a biochemist, I operate on the principle that if I can't perceive it empirically, I just don't believe it." I said, that's the principle you operate on. She said, "Yes." I said, "Could you set forth that principle empirically?" It's a presupposition. It's not empirically perceived. It has to be grasped with the mind, you see. And it was a contradiction. Her very principle was internally contradictory. And she just blew her mind. She said, "Nobody's ever said that to me." She said, "Everybody at Brown University operates on this principle." Well, I know that's not true. There's Christians teaching at Brown University too. But she had just engaged in this thing without real thought. So you take the definition, you know, it has to be empirically perceived to believe in it. And you look at that definition and appeal to it, and there's a contradiction inherent in the definition. And when she saw the contradiction, it broke her out of the lethargy of this false notion, and she was able to move on. The next year, she came and visited again. And I said, hey, it's good to see you. How are you doing now? She says, I'm an agnostic now. That's progress, people. That was progress. If I deny objective reality as a means to confirm or deny the truth or falsehood of any claim that might be made, then I am left with mere subjectivism. Again, self-referential and utilitarian. And when the self-referential achieve power, they become tyrants. On the other hand, this subjectivism that Lewis writes about, he also writes in an essay called The Poison of Subjectivism, that it can be destructive and it could also become the means of evil, whether it be political evil or religious evil, even. He wrote this, "One cause of misery and vice is always present with us in the greed and pride of men. But at certain periods in history, this is greatly increased by the temporary prevalence of some false philosophy. Correct thinking will not make good men of bad ones, but a purely theoretical error may remove ordinary checks to evil and deprive good intentions of their natural support. An error of this sort is abroad at present. I'm not referring to the power philosophies of the totalitarian states, but to something that goes deeper and spreads wider, and which indeed has given these power philosophies their golden opportunity. I am referring to subjectivism." That self-referential approach to life. Later that same year, after he wrote those words, Lewis turned his essay, The Poison of Subjectivism, into the book, The Abolition of Man. There was an occasion and an influence for writing the book. Lewis had received a grammar textbook that was written for use for fifth form in England. That would be students maybe 16, 17 years old as they were studying English. And he saw that this grammar book... Have any of you read The Abolition of Man, by the way? Any of you? Yeah, Lewis felt it was one of his three best books that he wrote, The Abolition of Man. This book was actually included in the Great Books of the Western World in 1968 by Mortimer Adler and his associates at the Encyclopedia Britannica. The other books would be Perlandra, the second book of his space trilogy, and Till We Have Faces, that haunting novel where he takes the myth of Cupid and Psyche and turns it into a novel. But this book is so profound and I think philosophically so astute and so tightly written and so clear. I've read all of Lewis's books over and over again. This one I lost track of at 60. 60 times I've read it at least. And it's really profound, and I hope I can communicate its profundity, because I believe if Lewis was here today assessing our situation, he would drive us back to this book, the wisdom of this book. So he had received this grammar textbook, and he was asked to write a review. In America, we have this woman on American television called Oprah Winfrey, and she has this book club. Do you know about her? In your part of the world, she has this book club, and if she refers to a book, they say just to her mentioning a book will increase the sales 20,000 or more copies. Well, if Lewis wrote a positive review of this grammar book, it would increase its sales, you see. But Lewis read the grammar book, and he says, oh my, there's all kinds of false notions and false philosophy embedded in this book. So rather than calling it by its actual name, The Control of Language by Alec King and Martin Ketley, not wishing to embarrass the authors, he simply called it The Green Book, because it had green covers, and he called the authors Gaius and Titius. If you come to Wheaton College, where I teach sometime, we have the largest collection of C.S. Lewis materials in the world, and we have the Green Book in our library with all of his marginalia on it and so on. So, as a matter of fact, in Surprised by Joy, have any of you read that, his autobiography, Surprised by Joy? There's one place in there where he says his reading, as he was an atheist, his reading started to close in on him. The books that he really liked were written by Christians. The books that he should have liked that were written by non-Christians, he didn't care for. He read Don Juan by Lord Byron, and Lord Byron, he said, I should have been in league with his beliefs about life, because my beliefs were just as subjectivistic as Byron's. But he said, I read that book, and as soon as I read it, I wrote in the back cover, never again, because he hated the book. And that if you come to Wheaton College, I can pull the book off the shelf and show you in Lewis's writing. There it is right there. He refers to it as Surprised by Joy. So not wanting to embarrass the authors, he calls it the Green Book by Gaius and Titius, but he takes to task the ideas embedded in the book. Lewis saw subjectivism embedded in it and buried as an assumption in each of its pages. Long before postmodernism, he sets out to deconstruct this text. By the way, his Abolition of Man created quite a stir. Even B.F. Skinner, the behavioralist, in part reacted to Lewis when he wrote his Beyond Freedom and Dignity. Mortimer Adler, as I mentioned, had honored the book by including it in the great books of the Western world. Furthermore, if any student of Lewis wants to grasp the core of his rational approach to thought, that student really must study this book. And I'll set forth the argument of the book. Then I'm going to evaluate the strengths and weaknesses of his argument, and then I want to apply the argument to how we might make judgments about beauty, or even how we might make judgments about morality. I think this will be helpful to us. The argument of the book. In The Abolition of Man, he begins the first chapter, and it's called Men Without Chests. He notes that Gaius and Titius, failing in their task to write a substantive grammar book, set out to fortify students against being emotionally swayed by propaganda. They were writing during World War II, and they were afraid that, in fact, students could be propagandized. When Aristotle writes his ethics, excuse me, not his ethics, when he wrote his rhetoric, he said that a persuasive message has to have three components. The first thing is logos. Logos, and it speaks of the content of a message. If you're going to say something, you better make sure you have something to say. All right, there's got to be content. The next thing is you consider the ethos of the speaker, and this would have to do with the credit of the speaker. If I was going to sell you Hair Restorer, you know, I want you to buy this product from me, and if you put it on your head, you'll grow hair. You're probably not going to buy it from me. You know, I might be able to sell it to Jim back there, but you're not going to probably buy it from me. Because you either assume, one, I didn't believe enough in it to try it, or if I did try it, obviously it doesn't work, you see. So I lose credibility. I don't have any ethos with you. But also I have to consider the ethos of the audience. If we were in America and you were the Young Republican Club, we have two major political parties, the Republicans and the Democrats, and you were the Young Republican Club, and you had invited me as a Democratic candidate for president to come speak to your club, I need to be aware of the ethos of my audience. So consequently, I just can't come spouting my position because you're already angry at me and you're just going to take shots at me anyway. So I come, and Augustine says you can deflect some of the hostility of an audience with humor. So I might tell you a joke about Democrats, and you laugh because you like to laugh at Democrats anyway. Then I tell you a joke about a Democratic candidate for president. You laugh again, and you say, wow, this guy's funny. I better listen to him. And consequently, I've at least gained your ear without judgment. You might judge me later, but I think you're going to hear me. So the ethos of the audience is important, and the ethos of the speaker. But the third element for persuasion is pathos. Pathos, and it has to do with the emotion of the speech. In order to move a person to action, the speech should have an appeal to the emotion. Walt Disney, when he made movies, said he never made a movie without trying to give people both laughter and a tear, and so on. Well, if you have Gaius and Titius writing the Green Book, they're concerned about the emotional propaganda of their day. They see that Hitler had motivated his people and he used emotion. They saw people in the counter statements against Hitler were using emotion to persuade and move people. Well, it is true. If you sever pathos from logos and ethos, you will have propaganda. But if you sever pathos from logos and ethos on this side of the ledger, you will have boring speeches, you see. So you need all of these as three facets of a single attempt to communicate. And Lewis is not convinced that Gaius and Titius have assessed the situation properly. It's true there is a bad sentiment out there. But he said what we don't need is we don't want to cut down jungles. He says we need, as educators, to irrigate deserts. And the task of the proper educator is not to guard against false sentiments, but to inculcate just sentiments. And just sentiments would be those sentiments, those emotional responses to things that are, in a sense, in line, the scoliosis of our emotion, in line with the plumb line of reality. Okay? And this becomes very, very important to Lewis. He says he thinks they miss the educational need of the moment. And consequently, they drift towards a kind of false philosophy. And the false philosophy Lewis is going to be concerned about is subjectivism. He tells a story in the book about Coleridge, the English poet, Samuel Taylor Coleridge, Romantic era, who in 1803 was on a vacation with Wordsworth. And Wordsworth, William Wordsworth, the poet, and William Wordsworth's sister, Dorothy Wordsworth. And they were on a vacation in Scotland going along the Clyde River. And they came to this waterfall, the Coralin Waterfall. And Wordsworth was at the waterfall. And while he was at the waterfall, there were two tourists there. And these two tourists, looking at the waterfall, one said the waterfall was pretty. The other one said the waterfall was sublime. Coleridge agrees with the one who says it's sublime. And does not agree with the one who says it's pretty. Gaius and Titius, responding to the story, say, Coleridge had no right to make that judgment. For these two weren't saying anything about the waterfall, they were just saying something about their own feelings. Now look what's happened here. Gaius and Titius, the authors of the Green Book, say, objective reality doesn't matter. They were just saying something about their feelings. Lewis says, no, Coleridge believed that there really was a waterfall there and that these comments had merit or lack of merit contingent upon whether or not they were accurately representing the waterfall. Neither of them said it was ugly. They both said positive things about it. But this first tourist was less refined in his judgment, and this tourist was more refined, had a more robust description. And Coleridge believed that these statements merited or did not merit based on the reality. Now, where it gets really sketchy is here. Gaius and Titius say Coleridge had no right to make the judgment, but what are Gaius and Titius doing? They're making a judgment. And if Coleridge has no right to make the judgment, because this doesn't matter, what's the basis on which Gaius and Titius are making a judgment about Coleridge? And they have severed any kind of feature that will allow them to validate or invalidate a judgment. So therefore, they become self-referential. And it becomes dangerous, very dangerous. In this act, the authors of the Green Book have severed both emotion and thought from any kind of objective reality. Lewis's criticism is severe. He writes, Gaius and Titius, while teaching him, the student, nothing about letters, have cut out of his soul, long before he's old enough to choose, the possibility of having certain experiences which thinkers of more authority than they held to be generous, fruitful, and humane. Lewis argues, Until quite modern times, all teachers and even all men believed the universe to be such that certain emotional reactions on our part could be either congruous or incongruous to it. Believed, in fact, that objects did not merely receive, but could merit our approval or disapproval, our reverence or our contempt. The reason why Coleridge agreed with the tourist who called the cataract sublime and disagreed with the one who called it pretty was, of course, that he believed inanimate nature to be such that certain responses could be more just or ordinate or appropriate to it than others. And he believed correctly that the tourist thought the same. For judgments to have that validity at all and meaning, they must be tethered to reality, otherwise they become anarchistic. For Lewis, this was really important, and we live in a culture right now that is drifting wildly towards this kind of subjectivism. That's why I think this would be something that Lewis would reassert if he were to show up today. Lewis wrote, "The right defense again against false sentiments is to inculcate just sentiments. By starving the sensibility of our pupils, we only make them easier prey to the propagandist when he comes. For famished nature will be avenged, and a hard heart is no infallible protection against a soft head." Here Lewis introduces what he calls then, for brevity, the Tao. It's at this moment in the book. And the Tao is a shorthand that he gives, Tao or Tao, you could say it if you want to. And he calls this basically the doctrine of objective value. It is the belief that certain things are really true and others really false to the kind of thing we are and the kind of thing the universe is. And so any time he mentions Tao, then, in this particular book, this is what he's referring to. He says that emotional states can be in harmony with reason. Augustine talked about ordo amoris, ordered love. You know, you can say you love your spouse. You can say you love your children. You can say you love an author, C.S. Lewis. You can say you love McDonald's hamburgers, something like this. But you don't mean the same thing in each of them. You don't love McDonald's hamburgers at the level you love your spouse. And so there should be this ordered love. Ordo amoris is what Augustine called it. And you're attributing to each thing the emotional value that it is worthy of or that it merits. Thomas Traherne says, "Can you be righteous unless you be just in rendering to things their due esteem?" You should give proper esteem to the thing that deserves it. And that's extremely important, to be discerning enough to know what deserves proper esteem and what should be not held in high regard. Lewis concludes the first chapter of this book by saying, "And at all times, such as the tragicomedy of our situation, we continue to clamor for those very qualities we are rendering impossible. You can hardly open a periodical without coming across a statement. What our civilization needs is more drive or dynamism or self-sacrifice or creativity. In a sort of ghastly simplicity, we remove the organ and demand the function. We make men without chests, without emotion, without proper and just sentiments. We make men without chests and expect of them virtue and enterprise. We laugh at honor and we're shocked to find traitors in our midst. We castrate and bid the geldings be fruitful." In the second chapter of the book, Lewis, having defined then this doctrine of objective value and showing how important it is to any kind of judgment we make, he says the fact that Gaius and Titius made judgments once they had stepped away from objective value, they must have had some way that they would validate their judgments. What was it? In chapter 2 of The Abolition of Man Called the Way, Lewis notes that the authors of the Green Book, having denied objective value, continue to make judgments. How do they justify these judgments? And Lewis says, "Since those in the spirit of Gaius and Titius may use things like instinct, utilitarianism, or economic value to justify their judgments, we have to explore, are these substantive enough to really validate a judgment that's made?" Lewis evaluates each one. Utilitarianism, it will be the sacrifice of some for the benefit of others. Is that enough to make a judgment? Because we don't know yet if the ones who are sacrificing the others are worthy of having the others sacrifice for them. Usually you would let the person who's going to sacrifice himself. We talked about Chernobyl a minute ago. There were people who went into Chernobyl to shut down that reactor, fully knowing that they would die. But they chose to die rather than let their families die who were outside the reactor. It's heroic. We saw the same thing in Japan when they had the tsunami. And there were some who went in there and did that. Now, it's one thing if somebody goes in and chooses to make that kind of great sacrifice. Or another thing if a group of people say, well, we don't like your race here. So consequently, we're going to create genocide here. And that's okay because it'll make life a lot better for us. Utilitarianism is not strong enough to give us an overarching understanding of what's just. So Lewis rejects that particular view. He says they might have done it by virtue of economic value. In America, I don't think that you can mess with nature without having consequences as a result. So some people said, well, you know, there are some unwanted babies in this country, and there are people that are suffering economically because of this. If we allow them to abort their babies, maybe life will be better. So here we are now, 30, 40 years later, and what's happening in our country? Well, Social Security is about ready to tank because one third of the people who paid into it are gone. The housing market is falling apart because one third of the people who might have been buying houses are gone. Our country's always worked with a minimum wage worker who didn't need benefits at work because they got the benefits from their parents at home. But we've eliminated one third of the minimum wage workers, and we have to turn a blind eye to illegal immigration because we need the illegal immigrants in our country. Economic value caused greater economic crisis. In China, they had the one baby. You guys know about that particular sociological thing. Too much population will have one baby. People said, we want boys. They started aborting their girls or leaving their girls out to the elements or adopting them out of the country, whatever. And now they have a country that's about 60-40 males versus females. And it's a major crisis. You can't mess with nature and not have critical things begin to occur. And if you live in denial because you've rationalized how you've messed with nature for economic reasons and so on, if you lived in denial, you might not even see what the outcome is when the outcome starts to reveal itself to you. Lewis looks at this economic value and he sees we've got a problem. Also, it still doesn't give you enough to judge by. In America, we fought a war, the Civil War. There were a lot of things involved. There were race issues involved. There could have been some people, though, who in the North said, we need to fight this war because the Southerners using slaves can produce goods at a cheaper price than we can. And the Northerners could have said, we need to fight this war for our economic benefit. And there could have been somebody maybe in the North who would have said, I'm not going to let my son or daughter go and fight a war for the Northern industrialists. But the question was there a slave issue that was a moral issue that was really at stake? Lewis says if war is ever just, then sometimes peace would be sinful. It's hard to make the judgments. Is this war just or not? I'm not going to in any way suggest I know. But if we're making it based on economic value, we'll always come up somewhat bereft of any kind of substantive moral judgment. And so Lewis sees economic value doesn't work. And then he says, well, some people might say we can make our judgments based on instinct. You look at Rousseau and Voltaire, who thought that instinct was a way to go. If we could get to the unadulterated culture that wasn't burdened by any kind of moral value put on them by the church or something like this, we could finally be free. But Rousseau, in his attempt to be free, had 5 illegitimate children by his own estimates. And what did he do with the illegitimate children? He left them with foundling homes in France that were run by religious people. So he left the religious people to clean up the mess that he had made and raise the children that he had made. Instinct isn't enough. And Lewis says, too, how do you determine which instinct is the one you should listen to? You've got a paper you've got to turn into college. You waited till the last 2 days before you wrote the paper, even though you knew you should have written it earlier in the school year. So you stay up all night. You don't get any sleep. You don't go eat. You're hungry. The only thing you did was you drank a lot of coffee. The paper's due right away. If you don't get it in, you won't get the better grade to get into grad school so that you can get the better job to take care of yourself. And so what do? The morning the paper's due, you've got to go to the bathroom, you've got to turn in the paper, you're hungry and you're tired. What do? And Lewis said the instincts themselves don't give you any kind of hierarchical suggestion as to how you should monitor them. But my guess is you'd probably all go to the bathroom real quick. Then you'd go turn in the paper because the due date is there. And then you'd either maybe decide, am I going to sleep first or am I going to eat and then sleep? Probably we would eat and sleep, right, if we're starving. But nevertheless, something has to transcend instinct. Instinct's not big enough. And Lewis sees in the second chapter that if the authors, Gaius and Titius, suggest, well, we could come up with an economic value like this, and they say instinct or utilitarian values, or they say economic values and so on. Lewis says it's not big enough to account for the wide range of things we are faced with. And it is a pseudo-Tao. It's a false reality. If it has any legitimacy at all, it takes it from the Tao, the doctrine of objective value. But it always shapes it and cuts it and needs it to things that the particular person who's impressing that value may want at that particular time. So Lewis evaluates each of these pseudo-Taos and shows their subjective nature. And each pseudo-Tao cloaks the mere inclinations of individuals or parties and rationalizes the subjectivism either individually or corporately. The doctrine of objective value is the sole source of value judgments, Lewis claims in this book. There may be abuses at times by those claiming to have objective commitments. And Lewis points that out, that the worst of bad men, again, could be religious bad men who maybe make great claims for themselves but still have abused subjectively. In Plato's Laws, however, Plato wrote, an abuse does not nullify a proper use. If you judge any segment of society by its worst examples, who could stand? Nobody could. So the abuse doesn't nullify the proper use. I was talking to a woman recently, and she said she was leading a group of students. She was a counselor at a high school in America, so it'd be like 14-year-old to 18-year-olds. And she was taking them on a work project in the Dominican Republic. And I saw them in an airport, all with their T-shirts, 360 work project, all this stuff. And I said, oh, what are you doing? She said, we're going to work in an orphanage in the Dominican Republic. I said, oh, is it a faith-based thing? She says, oh, no, it's not faith-based at all. So that's interesting. I think about Christians going and doing faith-based work, but do they declare the gospel or not declare the gospel? If they don't declare the gospel, how are we any different than some secular group that goes and does work in these agencies and so on? But I said, well, are you yourself a faith-based person? I said to the school psychologist. And she said, well, I grew up in a Catholic church, and I would have said I was a faith person, but not anymore. I said, what happened? She said, there was a priest at the school, and my sister and I were close to him, but then the story came out that he had abused a bunch of kids at the school. And she says, I've just rejected the whole thing. I said, well, was that obviously you were deeply hurt, and I get that, but was that a fair judgment even in the midst of your pain? Because at this end of the spectrum, you've got the priest who abused kids, but what about somebody, say, like Mother Teresa at the other end of the spectrum? Do you think Mother Teresa was a chump? Do you think she lived foolishly? And she says, oh, no, she was a hero. And I said, okay, well, somewhere then between this spectrum of this priest who did poorly and Mother Teresa, there maybe would be a better cutoff line than to say you reject the whole thing. Again, to think objectively about these things, to not overstate the case. She was ready to say an abuse did nullify a proper use, and she should say an abuse doesn't nullify a proper use. If you judge any segment of society by its worst examples, nobody could stand. And those overjudgments are basically projective. Lewis says the doctrine of objective value admits development. He says you like your vegetables fresh, then why not grow a garden and make them perfectly fresh? There's room for development of our judgments. Objective reality is relatively fixed, but our understanding ought to be developing or it will calcify. In the third chapter, Lewis then goes on to say, what happens if somebody accepts the values of subjectivism? And he basically believes that man's conquest over nature without transcending moral principles to guide will become the conquest of some men over others. It will become man's conquest over man. It will be the destruction of the society that accepts it. Lewis writes, either we are rational spirit obliged forever to obey the absolute values of the Tao, the doctrine of objective value, or else we're mere nature to be kneaded and cut into new shapes for the pleasures of masters who must, by hypothesis, have no motive but their own natural impulses. Only the Tao provides a common human law of action which can overarch rulers and ruled alike. He writes, a dogmatic belief in objective value is necessary to the very idea of a rule which is not tyranny or an obedience which is not slavery. And then in the appendix of the book, Lewis gives illustrations of the Tao, hosts of examples from sources from all kinds of world literature in the appendix of the Tao. Okay, so those are the three chapters of the book. I want to take and evaluate the book, because I think that the argument in the book has weaknesses in some places and has strengths in some places. And even if we look at how we might evaluate it, that might be helpful to us, not only in evaluating others of Lewis's books, but evaluating things generally. But then I want to apply the strength of what he said to the issue of beauty and morality. Okay? So we've got 10 minutes left before this session's over. Does anybody have a question? Okay, then let me put up some standards for evaluation. Okay? And this comes from Richard Weaver. Richard Weaver was a rhetorician at the University of Chicago. And he wrote several books, but one of the books he wrote was The Ethics of Rhetoric. And The Ethics of Rhetoric is, how do we judge if an argument is ethical or unethical? And he sets forth four types of arguments. The first type of argument is the argument from definition. The argument from definition. If I have a definition, I've got something I can appeal to. There's something substantive there. And if I have inferentially moved away from that which is coherent with the definition, I can go back to the definition and say, is this a fair inference? So definition. But sometimes I can't get to, and that's the most ethical, by the way, form of argument. But sometimes I can't get to a definition. What does the word definition mean, literally? Huh? It does mean boundaries, exactly. Day of the finite. To define a thing, it has to be small enough for me to wrap around words around it, and distinguish it from something else. The fist from the chair, from the coat to the pad of paper. Okay? So how do I define God then? We define things by virtue of their limitation and their function. How do I define God if he's infinite? I've got a problem. So the second form of argumentation is the argumentation from similitude. Similitude. It's like this, you see. I can't quite get to it. The medieval theologians would talk about speaking of God as the way of analogy. And they would give pictures. How did Jesus, when he talks about the kingdom of heaven, says the kingdom of heaven is like. He uses simile. He uses figures of speech. Metaphors, parables, and that sort of thing. Use a story, basically. This is the second most ethical. This is the most ethical, second most. The third, he believes, is the worst form and the least ethical form of argumentation. It's the argument from consequence. We hear this all the time in America. I don't know what's going on in your countries, but you'll hear this around political discussions too. If you vote for my opponent in this election, the whole country is going to go to hell in a handbasket. We don't know what's going to happen. So it's an appeal to nothing. The reality doesn't exist. We just assume that reality is going to be there. And out of that, we create fear in the hearts of our listeners, and we motivate them by fear based on nothing. It's totally manipulative, the argument from consequence. The fourth form of argument he doesn't give an ethical approach to. It doesn't give an ethical valuation to it. It's the argument from authority. It's when I really don't know how to argue, so I quote somebody else. It's when I put together books like the quotable C.S. Lewis and stuff like that. So anyway, if you look at the abolition of man, in fact, and you hold it up to this standard, I would suggest to you that this is chapter 1. And it's by far, It's the argument from definition. He sets forth the doctrine of the Tao. He defines it. He gives a depiction of Coleridge at the waterfall and why Gaius and Titius were wrong when they severed themselves from the objective reality that made any kind of meaningful statement out of Coleridge's words. And if they separated it and still made judgments, they were violating their own definition, and consequently we could see that what they were saying was bad. All right? The second chapter, he says, okay, if they don't have the Tao, then maybe they have something like this, and he argues from the point of similitude. The third chapter, Lewis says, what's going to happen if we violate, if we get rid of the Tao? Well, the whole world's going to go to hell in a handbasket. You know, and so the third chapter is the weakest. It seems a little bit incendiary. And then the last section, which is the appendix is section 4 of the book, and it's an appeal to authority. Look at all these other people who have said this. It's interesting to me that it breaks down pretty well, and Weaver helps define for us why we can make those judgments about the strengths and weaknesses of the book. But now I want to make application. Any comments about this? Is this helpful to you? It's pretty interesting, isn't it? Are there any other comments? Because I want to go. How much time do we have left for this section? It's time? Okay, good. We'll then evaluate this and put it in relationship to making judgments about beauty and morality in our next hour. And then we're going to move on to Lewis and what the use of story, evangelism and story. I want to do evangelism and story in our last times together. Okay. We've evaluated the argument of the abolition of man, and now we will seek to make application of this argument. Just to show you ways it can be used and why Lewis's words in a world where there's so much subjectivism, why Lewis's words can be helpful. I would not call The Abolition of Man a book in Christian apologetics. I would call it a book in common sense. And sometimes some of the arguments for the abolition of man must be set forth before you can do Christian apologetics, because you need to at least come to some common terms with other people. It becomes very important. But in application to Lewis, to beauty, Lewis makes this statement. And by the way, I need to again say, object, subject. So can I say something is beautiful, make an objective statement that's beautiful, not just beauty in the eyes of the beholder where I'm projecting on whatever I want to be beautiful, something that's it's a substantive statement. Lewis wrote, and there is really no reason why we should not do the same about standards of beauty, that is, apply objective standards to judgments of beauty. There is no reason why our reaction to a beautiful landscape should not be the response, however humanly blurred and partial, to something that is really there and is really beautiful. I may not have a complete understanding of this. I may not be able to articulate it completely, but could I make a reaction that would be appropriate to the thing itself? If there's such a thing as truth and beauty, then we must account for both the objective features we call beautiful and also one's subjective appreciation for those things. And so Thomas Aquinas made a judgment. Thomas Aquinas, the great Italian theologian, right? We've got Leonardo here from Italy. Yes. Thomas Aquinas. He said that when we talk about an object, objective beauty in the thing itself, he called it admirable. It's intrinsic to the thing itself. Whether I attribute it to that thing or not, whether I perceive it or not, it is beautiful. C.S. Lewis, when he was a boy, said that he never saw beauty when he was little. He had never seen a beautiful building, he said. I went to his boyhood home. I gave some lectures in Ireland about C.S. Lewis, and the people who arranged the lectures knew the woman who owned his home, and she let me go all around for 2.5 hours, all around this massively large house, and see the things that he had written about in his books, see them with my own eyes. And he said he didn't think a building could be beautiful. His house was stunningly beautiful. The entry of his house, just where you come in the door, was almost twice the size of this room. Big house. He came from means. I think he came from a wealthy family. You don't pick it up. And you can't came in the room. And it was all brown wood, very dark, dark wood that went up to the ground floor, covered the ground floor. There was a huge fireplace that you could walk into, stand up and walk into it. And it had cobalt blue tile and bronze all around it. And it was made in Norway and shipped to his parents' home in Ireland just to be put into the home. There was a winding staircase that went up to the second floor. On the second floor, all the stained glass windows in the places where there were windows on the first floor, but all clear windows at the top, so that you had all this light coming in from the top, but dark down below. Stunningly beautiful. But Lewis said he had never seen a beautiful building. Doesn't mean that he wasn't in the proximity to beautiful buildings. He had just never had the response whereby he said, wow, that's beautiful. He said that when he was a boy, his brother, Warren, brought a garden, a toy garden, into the nursery that he had made on the lid of a cookie tin. And he had moss and dew and leaves and stuff. And Lewis said, what all the real gardens had failed to do to me, that garden did. It awakened in me a sense of beauty. So the real gardens had beauty there. There was admirable beauty. It was objective. But Lewis did not have his own subjective response in line with the objective beauty. But once it awakened in him this sense of beauty, then he would see more. He could develop further. So Aquinas calls the objective beauty admirable. The subjective response, our ability to appreciate the beauty, he calls this enjoyable. Enjoyable beauty. One time I said to my wife, I thought Picasso was an idiot. And my wife said, really? What do you know about Picasso, the artist? And I had to admit I didn't know anything. She said, okay, the first thing we must do then is renegotiate who the idiot is here. And then we need to see if that idiot is educable. They were having a huge Picasso exhibit at the Chicago Art Institute. And we went to see it. And I said, oh my, there's more here. I just didn't know. And then one year we went to Barcelona, Spain. And we saw the Picasso Museum in Barcelona. And I said, oh, he is a great artist. I had no idea. He's still not my favorite artist, but I see. And the problem was not with Picasso's art. The problem was with my perceptivity. So we need to get our subjective appreciation in line with the objective value. Okay, so in order to do this, if beauty is objective, then what is it intrinsic to the object that makes it beautiful? By the way, when I talk about getting my eyes to see these things, let's do a little experiment, okay? If I asked you with one line to turn that into a 7, is there anybody who could do that? With one line, turn that into a 7.
Put another bar.
Please come, show us how you would do this.
Into a 7.
Into a 7. Here you go.
I take my words back. It takes more than one bar.
No, one line without taking the pen off the paper, turning it into 7. I think you're right.
Well, I mean,
very good. That's very good. You turned that into a 7. Very good. I'm impressed. Very, very good. Okay, now. With one line, without lifting the pen from the paper, is there anybody who can turn that into a 6?
Before and take off X.
One line. Just one line. You can't lift the pen from the paper. How would you do it? Yes, come. Come, show us, Mark. It's very important. Okay, do you see what he did? All right, now here's the thing. I shared with you this, and you locked into the worldview of Roman numerals. When I put the IX there, you're still thinking within that limited parameter. Reality is iconoclastic. You see, there's Lewis again. So now we have to think in the words of letters. Okay, so now let me ask you another question. Is there anybody else with one line who can turn that into 6 doing something different than what was done?
Well,
What was the question?
Can you turn this into a 6 without using Roman numerals and without using letters?
Like cross and put 6.
One line. Go ahead. What were you saying?
I don't know.
Was that what you were going to suggest?
And cross this one.
But that would be it. 1 times 6 is 6, right?
Oh, yes.
Well, now we can start to do all kinds of things. And if I say, can you do more than one line? Then you start saying, let's see, 4 times 1.5, you know. We can start to do all kinds of our algebraic symbols and so on. So we have to think outside the box that there's always things to be seen that are beyond our grasp at a particular moment. Or here's another one right here. All right, quickly, as soon as you see them, how many squares are there?
17.
Shout out, what'd you say?
17.
17?
No,
21, 22.
Huh?
22,
no.
Give me more, say it. 10?
20?
More than 30, for sure.
Now, you guys are all looking at the same thing and you're seeing different things there. It's very interesting, isn't it? We could be looking at the same thing. There's an objective reality, but our subjective response is different. Okay, there's actually 30 squares there. There's the one big one and the 16 small ones. That's 17. 18, 19, 20, 21, 22, 23, 24, 25, 26, counting the fours, 26, 27, squares of 9, 28, 29, 30, 30 squares. Now we all see. In light of this, there can be sometimes a benefit of expert opinion. Somebody who studied it a little bit more. My wife had studied Picasso. She knew what he was doing. And so consequently, she was able to show me and open my eyes to see things I hadn't seen. How often we make judgments when we don't have full knowledge about things. Okay, so if in fact we could apply Lewis's abolition of man to judgments of beauty, and we see that there's admirable beauty, the objective, intrinsic in the thing itself, and a subjective response, what are the objective characteristics that we could identify that are in the object? In the Summa Theologica, Thomas Aquinas sets forth 3. If there's 3, there could be 103. You know, a more robust and a deeper understanding might ferret out more. But the first one, he says, is integrity. Integrity. That the work of art needs to have integrity. It needs to capture what it is seeking to reveal. The artist sees something. If he's going to make a true artistic statement, he must be able to identify something in the object and capture it for us. We make judgments relative to integrity all the time. I don't know how it is in your countries, but in America, at Christmas, we go and we buy Christmas trees. Or maybe if we live in more remote regions, we go chop down a Christmas tree and we bring it into the home. Do you guys do Christmas trees in your homes? Okay. So which tree do you buy? You buy that tree. Or that tree. My guess is you buy this one. Why? We say this one has more beauty because it captures for us what our ideal understanding of tree is, Christmas tree. What shapes that ideal? If we're Platonic, we'd say these ideas come down from on high and we have an intuitive understanding of them. If we're Aristotelian, we say we've seen millions of trees. And consequently, the generalization of those many, many examples of trees approximate this ideal, you see. So there's integrity is one of the ways. Now we have to be careful about this because sometimes the artist will see something that we didn't see. There's a painting. Write this name down on this painting. It's Marcel Duchamp, and it's nude descending a staircase. Nude descending a staircase. And Google this painting. Doesn't look anything like a nude. Do you know the painting? It's one of my favorites. It's, huh? Duchamp, and it's nude, descending a staircase. Okay, it doesn't look anything like a nude. It's very metallic looking. But what you've got in this still picture is descent. You get the idea of descent. So he's looking at something, and he's saying, I am going to capture movement in this painting. And there's where the integrity comes in. So we have to be careful that while the artist may be looking at a particular thing, and we may have expected something else, we may miss what the artist's intent was, and therefore our judgment may be short-sighted. Okay? So integrity is the first thing. We look to see, does the art have integrity? And the integrity may be complex. The next one has to do with proportion. Proportion, okay? They say you capture things in threes or foreground, background. We're looking for proportion when we do a painting or something. You look at a child, and a child, you know, will do their painting, and they paint a house, and they paint a tree. The tree looks like a lollipop, right? And they paint the sun, okay? And all the space here is wasted. I remember when I was a little boy, I was in first grade, and Mrs. Reinhardt, the one who did the flashcards, remember her? She said she wanted us to do a book about ourselves. And it was called All About Me. I still have the book. The first picture is a big picture of me. I take up the whole page. The next picture is a picture of my parents. Each one takes up half a page or smaller. And then there's a picture of my brothers and sisters, and they're really little, you see. And then she says, okay, there's still more time. You need to draw another picture. And I didn't know what to draw. And she said, draw something you like. I like airplanes. So I drew an airplane. I went up to her afterwards and I said, Mrs. Reinhardt, I'm done. She says, there's still more time. You have to draw something more. I was not very creative, so I drew three airplanes. So then she said, I said, Mrs. Reinhardt, I'm done. And she said, Jerry, there's still time. Draw something else. So I thought, I'll draw time. So I draw a clock, okay? And I draw it. I still have the picture. Oops! It's not going to make it into a museum unless Salvador Dali signs it, right? Looks rather Salvador Dali-esque. So proportion. We're looking for proportion as we look at things that are beautiful. Now, if you look at faces, and we look at human form, human face, usually the face is well-balanced and proportionate. Most of our faces are not, if you look at them in the mirror. But we can make some judgments about this. The other thing, too, is on proportion. Again, there may be something the artist sees that we miss. There's a famous Picasso painting, and it looks like this. That's it. That's the painting. So what is that? Well, we kind of know. Somebody's sitting down and we're looking from the backside. Well, all he did was use the edge of the canvas. But he still creatively filled the entire canvas. Sort of a gestalt, you know, but it's got proportion at play. We sometimes will be quick to judge because we won't see what the artist's intent is. Which is also interesting, isn't it? A lot of times we will judge beyond what is seen. I've given up trying to judge people's motives. My own are such a mystery to me. How could I be so quick to judge another person's motives? It's interesting. All right, so proportion. And then the last one is clarity. Clarity or brightness. What kinds of days do you prefer? Do you prefer a heavy, overcast gray day? Or do you prefer the blue sky and no clouds? Or do you prefer a day where that canvas of blue sky has on it the texture of patchy clouds, and the leading edge of the clouds facing the sun has a ribbon of gold? And then just beyond that, you see the bright whiteness of the cloud, and then that whiteness slowly drifts towards ivory and dove and eventually gray, and the leading edge is dark gray. Or do you prefer a sunset day, where the sun is setting and now the colors painted against the clouds reveal gold and orange and salmon and shrimp and apricot and all these glorious colors? What is it that you prefer? And Aquinas was suggesting that we prefer that which is brighter and has more color and clarity and so on. Not Picasso, but Van Gogh was very much, this was important to him. Not only the colors, but the contrasting colors that caused them to stand off the page even more. So these three things were ways that he was able to, that we could apply Lewis's The Abolition of Man to the realm of making judgments of beauty. Okay? Any questions about this or comments? It's not an exhaustive thing. This is just a very elementary approach to the application. But I'm just trying to show that you can make judgments. This is beautiful. And it can be objectively stated. And you can validate it. And we can look at the thing and we can say, why would you call that beautiful? And you can begin to draw off of the canvas itself. Or off of the musical piece, or off of the whatever it might be, the statue, whatever it might be, and you could start to look at these characteristics and make these judgments so that the judgments are not nonsensical, they're rooted in reality at some level. And again, I'm telling you this is elementary. If we really wanted to know more, we'd bring the artist in and the artist could develop this further for us. There's room for expert opinion. Okay? But now, what about moral issues? If you say to somebody, you're living your life in dissipation, you shouldn't live like that. Can you make those judgments? Or somebody says to you, well, that's your opinion. But I don't know that you can make those kinds of judgments, you see. But if in fact what Lewis is saying is true, there must be a way to make application about moral judgments that would be fair. And this is what I would suggest to you. And I will borrow from Aristotle's Nicomachean Ethics. If you read The Abolition of Man and you read the footnotes, Lewis is quoting from the Ethics by Aristotle over and over again because he believes Aristotle is working with a common sense morality that is rooted in the objective world, you see. Aristotle is not a Christian. He's living hundreds of years before Jesus, but he's still looking at natural revelation and he's making judgments that aren't perfect judgments, but they're very helpful judgments and they're judgments that are tethered to sensical statements because they're rooted in reality. So what does Aristotle say? What is the supreme good? What is the end to which our activities ought to be directed? And he would say it is happiness. Now he doesn't mean happiness as circumstantial. He's talking about happiness as something that is, we can judge it as a good life, the good life. And you can't judge if a good life has been lived until you're nearing the end of that life. Just like you can't judge if it was a good football game or a good basketball game until you get towards the end. You can't judge it in the first 5-10 minutes. So what is then, if it's true that we're trying to live to have a life where we could say, I lived a good life. I lived not just circumstantially happy life, but a by and large happy life. I made good approximation of what an idealized understanding of happiness might be. What would be the characteristics of this? And Aristotle would say, the happy life is a life where all my basic needs are met. So I have physical needs, right? I have shelter. I have clothing. I have food and drink. I'm able to live where the water is good, where the air is good air, and so on. So my physical needs, my basic physical needs are met. I have sociological needs. I live in a society that's well ordered and well managed, where I have freedom. I don't have freedoms that are irresponsible. There's a man named Mortimer Adler, who's a philosopher in America, and he wrote a 2-volume work on the idea of freedom. It's called The Idea of Freedom. Each book is about 500 pages long. And he distills down freedom to 4 types of freedom. When we talk about freedom, we'll engage in equivocation if we don't clarify definitionally what we mean by it. There is what he calls natural freedom, just the ability to choose. I chose this, I could have chosen that. The more options I have, the freer I am, you see. Sometimes people will look at this kind of freedom as a freedom without restraint. There's an irony to it, though, because if I remove complete restraint, I may not be free. If my arm breaks here, it may be free in that it's not rigid anymore from wrist to elbow, but it's no longer free to function as an arm because it'll go in any direction, you see. So in that case, that kind of abuse to the arm, it's going to need splinting. C.S. Lewis says that obedience is the splint God places on the broken life that it might mend. So we can move from the freedom of lots of options. There's a paradox to that kind of freedom. And the paradox is I may have lots of options, but until I actually use the choice to pick one of the options, I haven't really exercised the freedom. It hasn't done me any good. But once I choose this particular option, I don't have the other options necessarily available to me. There's a paradox there. So it's the ability to choose. Could have chosen this. I did choose this. I had options. There's another kind of choice, though, another kind of freedom. And this is the ability to choose well. And that's a choice that's exhibited by wisdom. It's the kind of choice that Jesus talks about. Know the truth, and the truth will set you free. So it's informed understanding. There's another kind of freedom, and it's circumstantial freedom. The ability to choose without coercion, restraint, or duress, and to have the presence of enabling means. It's available to me circumstantially. If I am under coercion, if I am incarcerated or something like that, I'm not free to go about my work. If I want to take a trip around the world, but I don't have the money to do that, I'm not circumstantially free to do that. And the last form of freedom is a kind of circumstantial freedom, but it looms so large, Adler gave it its own category, and that is political freedom, granted freedom. You drive down the street, it's a red light, you stop your car. You let other people who have the green light go ahead of you. You curtail your freedom in that moment, knowing that one day they will be stopping at a red light and you will have the green. And so there's a give and take of this sort of political freedom granted by the state and so on. These can all be abused because we live in a fallen world, but we want the sociological benefits of living in a world where there is sociological freedom. It's guarded by political freedom. Politics aren't bad. Bad politics are bad. If we're sociological beings, societies need order lest they fall into chaos and so on. So we need sociological freedom. There's psychological and relational, to love and be loved, and these deep, deep needs and so on. And what does that require? If I'm a person who always wants everybody to love me, but I'm not willing to enter into loving relationship and assume responsibility for others, then why is that? What's psychologically broken in me? I can't live the good life if this is broken to that degree. Okay? We have spiritual needs. In our materialistic society, we find that we're becoming unfree because we are bound, because we're not acknowledging our spiritual needs and so on. Okay? Now, the good life is when all my basic needs are met. So now the question is, can I want more than I need? I need food. Can I eat too much food? Yes, and become fat. It could affect my health. Can I have too much sleep? I need sleep. Can I have too much and become lazy? Don't go to work, so I'm not making money, so I can't pay for my shelter. And so on and so on. So Aristotle says I need something else as well. I need character, or what he calls virtue. Actually, you'll find this in 2 Peter, we'll root it in Scripture, 1:1-11. You'll also find it in Mere Christianity in the section towards the back of the book on the cardinal virtues. So what are those virtues? I want to talk about these in a minute, because this is Application of the Abolition of Man. Lewis writes about it in his other book, Mere Christianity, and it will help us to see how we can live the good life and how we can make judgments about whether or not this is bad, and it's rooted in reality. There's a reality to which I am being able to make these judgments. I'm not just out of the willy-nilly, out of the air, making judgments and then tyrannizing people by virtue of those judgments. So virtue was seen as an integrated whole. And the first characteristic of virtue was courage. And courage was seen as the, these are all habits, by the way. One act of courage doesn't make me a courageous person. One act of vice does make me a person identified and defined by that vice. I only have to kill one person and I'm a murderer. One act of adultery makes me an adulterer. One lie, I'm a liar. Vice works differently than virtue. Virtue, one courageous act doesn't make you a courageous person. Virtue is identified by means of habit. It's becoming part of my life. If I am developing good habit, then it becomes such a part of my life that, as one person said, it's man's second nature. I don't have to think about it, I'm just doing it properly. Okay? So, courage is defined as the habit, the habitual ability to suffer pain and hardship. It's endurance, fortitude, and staying power. It's a habitual ability to suffer pain and hardship. It's endurance, fortitude, and staying power. Courage is the ability to say yes to right action, even in the teeth of pain. Who for the joy set before him, he endured the cross. Courageous act. Okay? Example of courage, it's not a sprint. I remember years ago in college, university, I was an American football player. A friend of mine was a person who did track. You say athletics or track? And he was a runner. And he wanted me to go run in a marathon race with him right after I had finished American football training, a season. Well, American football, you run hard for 6 seconds and then you breathe desperately for 30 seconds before you do the next play. And he wants me to go run in a 26-mile race. I was just a first year of university and I thought, okay, I'll go win this thing. You know, I thought, you know, you can do it without training, you know, I'm going to win this deal. And we got to this place, it's Palos Verdes, California, which is all hills, all big hills and stuff. And I get there, there's thousands of people for this race. I haven't trained one day for it. I didn't have shoes. This guy said, I've got an extra pair of shoes, and they didn't fit me. And I was going to wear socks. He says, no, the socks weigh so many ounces, and it's 26 miles, 385 yards to run this race. If you run this race and you have socks, it's like carrying the Queen Mary ship on your back. I didn't know at that time what a false analogy was, an informal fallacy in logic, but that was certainly one. So I didn't wear socks. I didn't wear shoes that fit. And I got down in a sprinter start to run this race. That's how stupid I was. There was a guy with a gun to start us off, and the photographer was there with the LA Times, and there was a television show that was going to be made of this and so on. So I just thought I was going to win. So the gun goes off, and I took off. I led the pack. I led the whole group for about 200 yards. And then I started getting this pain in my side, a stitch in my side, and I realized I still had 26 miles 185 yards to go. I finished 20 miles in about 3.5 hours. I lost all the skin on my feet from those shoes that didn't fit. I couldn't walk straight for 3 weeks. I was going to kill my friend, but I couldn't catch him because I was so beat up by this whole thing. And what I had to realize was that, like a marathon race, life is not a sprint. It takes courage to run it. It takes endurance. It takes fortitude. It takes staying power. Okay? So, courage. Aristotle saw this as the golden mean between foolhardiness, that would take any dare, and cowardice is courage. And again, it's the ability to say yes to right action, even in the teeth of pain. Okay? Did you have a question?
No.
No? All right, the next one was temperance. Temperance. And temperance is the mean between overindulgence and abstinence. Temperance is a habitual ability to resist the enticement of immediate pleasure in order to gain the greater though more remote good. It's the habitual ability to resist the enticement of immediate pleasure in order to gain the greater though more remote good. If courage is the ability to say no to wrong action, even in the teeth of, yes to right action, even in the teeth of pain. Temperance is the ability to say yes If courage is the ability to say yes to right action, even in the teeth of pain, temperance is the ability to say no to wrong action, even in the jaws of pleasure. Okay? My children, when they were little, this concerned me very much, that they were intemperate children. They would have, in those days, sold their souls for candy. I remember once when my wife was sick. She was upstairs. I said, "Don't worry, I will feed the children, make them dinner." She's in bed, and we had three children. We have four, but at that time we only had three. And so I made them some stew, and I put some stew in a bowl for my oldest child, and his bowl was filled up pretty good. My daughter, I put some stew in a bowl for her. She was middle-sized. I put a middle-sized bowl, like Goldilocks and the Three Bears, you know. My youngest son in a high chair, I gave him a very small portion because he was a little boy. I told my children, "I'm going to take some up to your mother. You can eat your stew. When you're done with your stew, you can get a popsicle from the refrigerator and you can go and eat it on the front porch." I took the stew up to my wife and I said to her, "Don't worry, the children are okay. I hope you're okay." I gave her a kiss. I left her with her stew. And as I came down the stairs, I saw my two oldest children running out the front door with their popsicles. And I thought to myself that there's no problem here. It was such good food that I made for them. They ate it quickly, you see. I go into the kitchen. My son's bowl is empty. My daughter's bowl is empty. My baby's bowl is piled high with stew. Those little stinkers. They just took and scraped theirs out and grabbed the ice cream, the popsicle, and they went outside with the popsicle. What was the problem? They did not say no to the temptation, but instead compromised their life in order to get to the sweets. And I realized I had to do something about this. I had to teach them temperance. Each day when I would come home from work, I would always bring something to my children. And when I would bring something, it might be maybe a doodle, a drawing. Or it might be for them maybe a piece of candy. There's candy you can buy in America. It's yellow cellophane wrapping on yellow butterscotch candy. I don't know if you have that here. It costs a penny in America. And I would bring it home, and I would say, "Do you want this candy?" You know, and I come home at the end of the day, Daddy, do you have a surprise? Do you have a surprise?" I'd give them the candy. But one day, instead of giving them the candy, I would say, "Before you take this candy, if you refuse it, I'll take you to get a toy tomorrow at the toy store for $10. Or you can have this penny candy right now. What will it be?" They all took the penny candy. I thought, I have my work cut out for me. I continued to do that until finally my oldest son one day said, "You know what, Dad? I think I'll take that toy." And he refused the penny candy, and the other kids all took the penny candy. They didn't suck on it to make it last. They just chomped it and chewed it up. And they looked at him like he was crazy. And he had some doubts, I saw. But the next day, we went and got that toy. And all of a sudden, he started to get it. And with each of my kids, there came the time where I tried to teach them. You can read about this in C.S. Lewis's Mere Christianity in the section on virtue. Temperance. It's a mark of maturity, this. And we can say, and it's rational. It makes sense. It's rooted in reality. The third one is justice. And justice is the habit of being law-abiding and concerned for the general welfare of one's society. It secures and protects natural rights. It's fair. It renders to others their due. Not only the punishment of the evildoer, but justice also renders praise for the well-doer. If you're in charge of a company or a church or a ministry, and you make sure that you take care of injustices when they occur at your place, that's only half the battle. What are you doing to build morale and build the people at your place as well? If you're not building their morale, you're not a just person. It's positive as well as negative. Justice is an attribute of God. God the Father, God the Son, God the Holy Spirit are just in relationship with each other. The Son praises, gives glory to the Father. The Father glorifies the Son. Holy Spirit glorifies the Son. There's positive expression of justice as well as negative. And both of those have to be operational. And justice says that my moral development is linked to my responsibility to others around me. Okay? And there's objective reasons for this. And then the last one is wisdom. Wisdom is the habit of being careful about the decisions one makes. It secures and it seeks counsel and advice. Wisdom. The habit of being careful about decisions one makes, it seeks counsel and advice. Wisdom requires that I benefit from perspective. Perspective that sees beyond my own vision. Years ago, we lived in England. And on weekends, my children would want to go to places where they had mazes or labyrinths. Do you know what those are? Labyrinth or a maze? Are you familiar with that? Is there anybody who doesn't know what I'm talking about? You know? Okay. So my children loved them. And there was this one in Hampton Court in London. It was a hedge 8 feet high. And you could pay a little bit of money and you could go into this hedge. And it was half the size of a football field, of a hedge. And you could be lost in there for a couple of hours and have so much fun. When you paid the proprietor at his box, next to the box there was a scaffold. And if you got lost in the maze, you could cry out for help and the proprietor would climb up on the scaffold and from his elevated position, he could get you out of the maze. The Bible is in some senses the wisdom from on high. It's the elevated perspective, the perspective of the scaffold that helps us through the maze of life. But sometimes too, it's our friends. It's other people in our life. We cannot in isolation live our lives and live them wisely. We need perspective beyond our own. So anyway, these are the kinds of moralities or the issues of morality that Lewis applies to the very concept of an objective approach to life. If Lewis were here today, what do I think he would say? To a culture that is in some senses hell-bent with self-referentialism, disassociated from living life that is connected with objective reality, I think Lewis would bring us to the abolition of man. He would underscore reality. He would underscore its complexity. Reality is iconoclastic. And I think that he would call us to the objective appreciation of beauty and the objective appreciation of virtue or character to be lived in this life. Does this make sense? I talk to students all the time. I teach at a university, and I have these students. I'm ordained also, so I've done a lot of weddings, maybe 900 weddings or something. So it's about 1,800 people, students I've married and so on. And they want premarital counseling and all this sort of thing. And I find that the students find a difficulty. Why would God make us with such strong sexual desire and yet say, no sexual expression until you're married? This seems crazy to us, they would say. And I would say, well, let's look at it. If God says, restrain yourself, he gives you desire, but restrain yourself. Could there be some wisdom in this? Could we look at this a little more deeply? And to look objectively at why God says to restrain yourself. You see these couples who start having sex before they're married. And once that enters into the picture, they hardly do anything else in their relationship. They marry a body they know well, but not a person they know well at all. And consequently, there's a sadness that develops. And then when crisis occurs, they don't really know who this person is that they're going through crisis with. And we start talking about the wisdom of it, rooted in reality and rooted in wisdom. And the man who influenced C.S. Lewis so much, George MacDonald, he said that obedience is the opener of eyes. Why does God call us to obey? And I thought about this too, that when God tells us to obey him, I don't understand very much. I think I'm a pea brain. You go to bookstores, big bookstores, or the libraries at your university. At Oxford University, the Bodleian Library has 130 miles of shelf space. Who's read all those books? But we're making judgments all the time, and we don't know very much. And with our very limitation, we see God calling us to obey. And there's an assumption in this, if God calls us to obey, that the good God of the universe has, out of the teeming omniscience of understanding, invited us to live in the benefits of omniscience. Every act of obedience allows me to live beyond my own abilities. But as I begin to live an obedient life to the omniscient call, I begin to understand why these things are so. Lewis writes about the violation of virtue. When I violate virtue, it leads to moral blindness. He says in a preface to Paradise Lost, continued disobedience to conscience makes conscience blind. On the contrast, obedience is the opener of eyes. So my understanding is affected even by how I live my life. Paul put it, we suppress truth in our unrighteousness, and consequently, there's great loss. All right. I realize I want to talk about Lewis as an evangelist and then Lewis's use of story as a rhetorical tool. But I also think these would be important things that he would have to communicate with us, since they were so much a part of his experience and so much a part, or reflected so much in his writing. But I realize I left something out in session two, we just finished session one. Because I took Abolition of Man, the prequel, Reality's Iconoclastic, Argument of the Abolition of Man, and then applying it to beauty and morality. But in session two, before I get into the evangelistic part, I do need to say, Lewis was very strong on understanding dignity and depravity in human behavior. Dignity, because we're made in the image of God. Depravity, in that we're fallen. And he says in The Weight of Glory, there are no ordinary people. You have never met a mere mortal. Every person you meet, if you saw them as they one day will be, you would be tempted to either fall down and worship them, as you will see them in their glorified state, or you would turn away from them in horror, equivalent to the worst things you've ever seen in your worst nightmares or horror films, basically. And he says, in every day, we are moving towards helping people towards one or other of these options. There's the idea of justice at play once again. Lewis's view and understanding of the nature of man is that man is good by nature. Man is good by nature. And we use the preposition by advisedly, because this preposition implies in it essence. What are you by nature? You are made in the image of God. That is good. But man is fallen in nature. Sin is an encroachment upon our nature, and that is bad. So we are good by nature, fallen in nature. Therefore, we always possess dignity, and we always have to account for our depravity. The dignity, interestingly enough, is such that we would say even the worst of sinners deserves a fair trial. Why? Because they still have the vestiges of something good. They were made in the image of God. Your theology is affected here at least four ways, how you understand human nature. First, your theology proper. That is your doctrine of God. If man is sinful by nature, God would have had to have made us sinful. But God made us, but he made us in his image. That was good. So God made us good. Second is your Christology. If man is sinful by nature, then if Jesus became fully man, he would have had to become a sinner. But the scriptures are explicit. He was tested in all points as we yet without sin. Okay. So did he become fully man, or are we Gnostics? He didn't become fully man, or docetics, or something like that. Three is your biblical anthropology. Biblical anthropology. We have four categories of man in Scripture. Adam and Eve before the fall. Was sin present? No. So sin couldn't be the defining characteristic. Adam and Eve and all who follow after, and we're in that category, is sin present? Yes. Christ in his humanity, is sin present? No. Man in his glorified state, we're not morphed into something other than man. We don't become angels or something like that. There's one place where Jesus says we're like the angels, but we're not angels. We are man in glorified state, the kind of thing that Lewis says there are no ordinary people. So you have four categories of man in Scripture. Sin's present in one, not in the other three. It can't be the defining characteristic. And then fourth is your doctrine of salvation, soteriology. If you see a pig wallowing in the mire, you don't kick the pig and tell it to get out of the mire. It wallows because it is living according to its nature. It doesn't have sweat glands. It has to wallow to keep its body cool. But if you see, and what if dogs don't have sweat glands? What do? They pant to keep their body cool. If you see a man living in sin and degradation, do you tell him he shouldn't live like that? I would hope you would. But if he's living according to his nature, let him go. Isn't the proclamation of the gospel itself a demonstration that we believe that man's not living according to his nature? You see. So he needs to be restored. In the scriptures, we have man made in the image of God. The whole redemptive history is to restore the image. Romans 8:28, all things work together for good to those who love God, those who are called according to his purpose. Romans 8:29, what is the purpose? What's the end? That we might be restored to the image of Christ. So for Lewis, this is really important. That we see and we understand this. And also then we have human responsibility to engage in an evangelistic enterprise. And the evangelistic enterprise is designed so that we could recognize, like justice, our lives are not properly fulfilled if we're not investing in the lives of others. So I want to talk about this because I think this is also something important. Lewis gave a talk once to a bunch of clergymen and youth pastors in the Church of England, and he says explicitly to them, "Woe to you if you do not evangelize." He wrote this in an essay called Christian Apologetics. It appears in the book God in the Dock, or the English version, Undeceptions. Woe to you if you do not evangelize. And he says too that when he wrote his books, he says, most of my books are evangelistic. Even his literary critical books that he wrote for his teaching posts at Oxford University and later Cambridge, you could lead a person to Christ from those books. His faith is implicit in everything he wrote after he became a Christian. He has integrated his faith in the learning process. If you integrate faith and learning, what's the mark that you have an outcome that shows you really understood how your faith was integrated? Shouldn't it be that you could take whatever the topic is and segue in a conversation with another person to the gospel? I think if you integrate faith, you could look at any topic and make it a place where you would begin to worship God, because you would see, you know, wow, what must God be like, as we talked about earlier. I think it could be a place that would evoke worship. I think it would be a place that would evoke some sort of Christian service. And I think it would be a place, if you understood that subject, where it would motivate you to connect or segue that topic to some sort of topic that would make a segue to the gospel. An example of this, if we were going to draw on Scripture, would be Philemon verse 6. Philemon 6. In the New International Version, it says simply this: "I pray that you may be active in sharing your faith so that you'll have a full understanding of every good thing we have in Christ Jesus." I pray that you may be active in sharing your faith so that you'll have a full understanding of every good thing we have in Christ Jesus. If I share my faith, what I discovered early on is that people ask me questions. And they would ask me questions about things I knew nothing about. When I was a young boy, I grew up in Los Angeles, and we were poor. We went to an inner city church. There was only one person in the whole church with a university education. Everybody else was fairly uneducated and so on. And there was a lot of bad theology that went around in that church. I was told as a boy that if I went to a movie and Jesus came back, he wouldn't go in the theater to get me. I would just go to hell forever. I wanted to see the Walt Disney movie, The Shaggy Dog, but I didn't know if it was worth risking my eternal destiny to go to see this in the theater. The neighbor lady, Mrs. Greenlee, came down and asked my mother if it was okay if my boys, or her boys, my brothers and me, went with her boys to see the movie. And I looked at my mother with ambivalence. I wanted to go to the movie on one hand, I didn't want to go on the other. My mother said, yes, we could go. And then I began to wonder if she really loved us, that she would put our lives in such eternal peril. So I had deduced as a child, if I could lose salvation based on what I did, I had to gain it based on what I did. And I never saw how the cross worked in that equation. I never understood grace till I got to college. And when I heard the gospel, I was ripe for the picking. I wanted to know I was loved. I wanted to know I was forgiven. And I didn't ask these deep questions, the great apologetic questions and so on of the faith. But when I went out to try and tell people about the love of Jesus and the forgiveness of Jesus, they asked the questions. And I needed to find answers. And so when I shared my faith, again, here's Paul, I pray that you may be active in sharing your faith, so that you'll have a full understanding of every good thing you have in Christ Jesus. You share your faith, people ask questions, you dig to try and find the answers, and you're growing. The other thing, though, too, is my life's a mess. You know, I need Jesus desperately. My need is not casual, it's constant. And when I came to faith, I had a lot of bad garbage in my life. And when I would share my faith, people would look at my life and they would see that it didn't match the message. And so these people would criticize me and say, we don't see how you could call yourself a Christian. Look how you're living your life. So I realized I needed to go deeper in my faith in Jesus. I needed to grow in a way that would authenticate my life. There was a man, do you guys do bumper stickers in your countries where people put bumper stickers on their cars that say stuff that, have you ever seen it before though? In America, you get some people, they go crazy about it. They have all kinds of bumper stickers on their car. And I knew a man once who said, I would never put a Christian bumper sticker on my car. I said, why is that? He says, if I did, I'd have to drive better. If you share your faith in Jesus, people are going to look at your life and they're going to scrutinize you. And it's another reason why Paul says, if you're active in sharing it. Huh?
It's happened to me, but I take off from my car.
Take it off, yeah.
God teaches to you how to drive the car.
Yeah.
My friend likes to say, when I'm driving, I'm not a pastor.
Yeah. Well, I think there are a lot of people who don't share faith in Jesus because of this, too. Because their life is not equal to what their message is, you see. So you start sharing your faith and people look at your life and they want to see the real thing. And I think that there, again, is some humility in this. Lewis writes in one of his letters, indeed, all of us are very difficult to live with. If we're honest about things, we're all very difficult to live with. I remember John Stott came to Wheaton College. The last time he came, he preached for about 15 minutes. There were 2,500 people at the gathering. Preached for 15 minutes, and he took questions from the students. One of the students raised his hand and said, Dr. Stott, how would you reach the postmodernists for Jesus? And Stott gave a very tight definition of postmodernism and a very tight definition of deconstructionism. And then he said, I think the way to reach the postmodernists is by being an authentic person. As soon as he said that, I went into existential despair because I know that I'm not an authentic person. I know that there are incongruities in my life, and I'm trying to do the best I can. But as I walked out of that auditorium that day, I was pretty beat up. And then as I got to the back of the auditorium, I thought to myself, you know what, I think there's only been one person who has been truly authentic. Only one person could say, I live my life the way it was meant and intended to be lived. And so, As I got to the back of the auditorium, I thought to myself, I think then if that's true, if Christ is the only truly authentic person, then the question changes a little bit. How does the inauthentic person begin to approximate authenticity? And I think the answer is by being honest about our inauthenticity. It's one of the qualities that you pick up in Lewis's writing. There's an honesty there about life and about how he recognizes this fact. And consequently, it keeps me hungering for Christ. It keeps me growing in Christ. It keeps me allowing Christ to scrutinize my life. When I see the failures, I don't have to beat myself up too much because This is the Christ who loves me. This is the Christ who forgives me. And I keep going back to Him. I keep going back to Him and growing and then going back, redeploying in the world to make the gospel known. So I grow. If I share my faith, people ask questions, I dig for answers. People scrutinize my life. I have to take that seriously and I apply it more deeply and I try to become a more authentic person. But the next area is I see Jesus showing up in my life. I have students all the time say, I want to see Jesus show up in my life. I say, let's go share Jesus with others, because when you see people give their lives to Christ, you'll see Jesus show up. My own belief is that we don't take Jesus to anybody. He's already there. We just go make explicit what He might be doing implicitly in that person's life. So I knew a man once, and he had started a church. Do you guys know about the church in America, pastored by Alistair Begg in Ohio? It's a church of about 6,000 to 8,000 people, something like that. But my friend, Walt, started that church. He started it with a Bible study, about 25 people. It grew to about 1,000 under his ministry, and then he went and became a missionary overseas. But while it was growing, he told me that he had a man at his church who was on the board, his elder board at the church, and this man was a very bright man. Walt had never seen his company that he had started, but he was an engineer, and he started a company where if you had a product that you were manufacturing and you needed a fleet of trucks to deliver that product, let's say it was perishable goods and you needed a refrigerator truck to deliver it, or let's say it was glass and you needed a way to deliver it so that the glass wouldn't get broken, this man would find out what you need. He would design the fleet of trucks for you. He'd get the chassis from Detroit, and then he would build these trucks. And he said to my friend Walt, I want you to come to my work one day, and I want to show you around, and then we'll go to lunch and we'll talk about church business. Walt said he went there and he couldn't believe the genius of this man. He started the company from nothing, and he had 500 employees. As they walked through the plant, he called each employee by name, asked them about things. Hey, how's the new baby? How's the bowling league? How'd it go the other night? How's this? How's that? People would come up and need advice, and he would look at the problem, and he would scribble out the advice, and they would go off on their way to apply the things that he did. He said, this guy was a genius. He said, I had known him for years at church, but I never really got to know him till I got to know him in his workplace. And the application is, we can know Jesus for years at church, but you'll never really get to know Him until you get to know Him in His workplace. This is what motivated C.S. Lewis to start the Socratic Club, to reach out to Oxford University students, to go during World War II to minister to the RAF airmen who were dying. These men were, I think, huge percentages were losing their life. And he was preaching every week. His professor, other professors and teachers at Oxford University would make fun of Lewis and denigrate him for doing this. But he felt it was necessary because these men were dying. This was a high passion in his life. He took shots for it and so on. He would be involved in outreaches in churches in London, actually all over England. During World War II, they said the second most heard non-BBC broadcast voice in England, after Winston Churchill, was C.S. Lewis. And his talking on the radio was always about things like Mere Christianity was first a BBC broadcast talk to proclaim the gospel and so on. It was high value for Lewis. And I think Lewis would say, in a day where it's estimated in America anyway, only 5% of the people, Christians, share their faith. 5%. That there's only 2.1% of the churches in America are growing evangelistically, where they're seeing conversion growth. Usually churches grow because this church has a lot of problems and the people leave that church and go to this other church. They call it transfer growth and so on. And we're losing out, I think. The sense of purpose, the sense of call, the sense of the winds of the Holy Spirit filling the sails of our lives. Lewis wasn't going to let that happen. He was going to go. So if you go and share your faith, what do you do? And I think that the first thing you do is you ask questions of people. And you ask questions and you wait for their answers and listen for their answers. You ask very public questions and listen for the information the person gives you. Because whatever information they give you, they also give you freedom to ask deeper questions about that. So if you say to a person, oh, where are you from? That's a public question. If they say, oh, I grew up in Albuquerque, New Mexico, but when my parents divorced, I moved to Chicago. They've given you information. that you can ask then further. And you can say, wow, your parents divorced. What was that like for you when you were 12 years old too? And let them talk with you. Ask them questions as they give you information. When you find out that the father never remembered their birthday or never remembered their Christmas, and they tell you that, what was that like for you? When they say, I don't know if I'll ever be able to forgive him, then you start talking about issues relative to forgiveness. You eventually find the place where there's a segue, and usually it's about relational things. Jesus talks to the woman at the well about water first. He talks to the man at the pool of Bethesda about health and sickness and so on. And you keep going deeper in the conversation. Now, C.S. Lewis says in one of his books, Pilgrim's Regress, that there are these deep longings. Actually, Lewis is the great exponent about human longing. If you read Surprised by Joy, you see that he had these deep intellectual questions, these barriers he had to get over. One of them was problem of evil. We'll talk about that on another session sometime this week. But that was an issue for him. He was an atheist for a while. He was a materialist for a while. How do you get over those particular barriers? He wondered what religion was the right religion when he finally becomes a theist. He had a lot of questions. But the thing that kept prodding him were these deep longings of his heart. And it seems to me as Christians, if we can understand the deep longings and we can make segue of the gospel to those longings and connect the gospel to the deep felt need of others, the gospel gets Velcroed and people respond. And so I want to look at these deep longings. And as I mention it to you, I have to say, that there was another person whose writings I got to by reading Lewis, and her name is Evelyn Underhill. And I think if I would have gotten Underhill before Lewis, I might have made her my life's author. They corresponded, and one of Lewis's friends, Charles Williams, edited her books or her letters after she died. But she made a statement about these deep longings as well, and I want to look at her statements about it and Lewis's statements and then consider the gospel in light of these longings. Underhill said there were three deep cravings of the self, three great expressions of man's restlessness which only mystic truth can fully satisfy. The first is the craving which makes him a pilgrim and a wanderer. It is a longing to go out from his normal world in search of a lost home or a better country. The next is that craving of heart for heart of the soul for its perfect mate which makes him a lover. And the third is a craving for inward purity and perfection which makes him an ascetic and in the last resort a saint. So she talks about three deep longings. She talks about the pilgrim longing. She talks about the lover longing. And she talks about the ascetic saint longing. Okay? In the first book that C.S. Lewis wrote after he became a Christian, it's called Pilgrim's Regress, he has this pilgrim named John who sees a vision of an island in this allegory. And John starts to head in the direction of this island, and he has all kinds of problems along the way. He eventually comes to a hermit. This is the only allegory Lewis ever writes. He comes to a hermit, and in this allegory, the hermit represents history. And John asks him about the longings. And hermit tells him three longings. There's three longings. Now, I want to suggest to you if there's three, there could be 303. But these longings that the hermit talks to John about in Lewis's book are, I think, synonymous to these. Lewis not only gives them a name in his book, he also attributes them to a time in history when they were developed. So the first one is the longing for myth. Or story. The second one, oh, and he puts this in classical times. It's developed in Greek and Roman times, this kind of longing. The next kind of longing is the longing for the lady, the image of the lady. He sees this in medieval. And he sees Dante, particularly, as the exponent of this kind of longing. Dante, the Italian poet. Have you ever heard of him, Leonardo? Just wondering. Right. You weren't here when I said earlier Lewis thought he was the greatest poet ever, Dante. Okay. You probably feel the same, right? And then the last one, he said, was the longing for nature. And this he sees in a romantic period. Here it would be the period late 1700s, early 1800s particularly. Wordsworth, Coleridge, Shelley, Novalis, Schiller, so on. Okay? So I would suggest to you these are synonyms. So let's unpackage them, because I think if we understand this in Lewis, it will help us be better at presenting the gospel as we see these longings start to emerge in conversations we have with others. So let's start with myth and pilgrim and classical period. Myth. Myth is just story. It's, sometimes we hear it in America, people think if you're talking myths, they use it as a synonym for lying. It's not about lying. Okay? Just story. The longing that's awakened by story. You're a child, and a better way to put it, Lewis writes in one of his literary critical books, Experiment Criticism, the mark of an unliterary person is that they read a book only once. The mark of an unliterary person, they read a book only once. Now, I don't want any of you to feel bad, but I'll bet we've got some literary people here. I'm sure if I said to you how many of you have read the Bible more than once, we could get several hands raised. There's at least one book about which you are a literary person. How many of you have read any C.S. Lewis books more than once? Yeah, the Narnian books, you literary people, you. How about Tolkien? Do any of you like Lord of the Rings or The Hobbit or any of those?
Yeah, but only one time because it's huge.
It's huge. But how about Dostoevsky? Brothers K. Have you read it more than once?
Huh? He's a hard one.
He's a hard one, but he's deep and good and rich. Or Tolstoy, War and Peace, or Anna Karenina, or something like this. Or Jane Austen, or even children's stories. What happens when you put a child to bed at night and you say your prayers and you read them stories and you give them their kisses? And if it was a good story that night, what does the child always say to you?
Read it again.
Read it again. Read it again. And Lewis says, why is it that we go back to some stories over and over? Or we want to hear some stories over and over? And he says it awakens in us a longing for the world of that story, which awakens in us a longing for the only other world we could ever really know, which is heaven. Heaven. And he thinks it touches us at the place of our longing for heaven. Now, in classical times, it was the pilgrim longing. So you have, say, in Homer's the Ulysses, or the Odyssey. What does Ulysses want to do? He's just been fighting in the Trojan Wars, and this guy from Greece, he's been gone from his wife Penelope for a long time. He's from Ithaca. He just wants to go home. And he has all these adventures he has to go through. He just wants to go home. Does it make sense? Ulysses, oh, you were trying to figure out what I was talking about. Well, you're an Italian, so I'll give you another one. Your world, right? Because we'll draw on classical literature from your world. How about the Aeneid? So here's Aeneas. He's a citizen of Troy. He's on the other side from Ulysses. And his city is destroyed. And while the city is burning down, he starts to escape. His wife's been killed. Hector, the crown prince, has been killed. And as he's escaping, he sees the ghost of each of them. And each one pronounces a prophecy over him that he will build another city. So he escapes with some ships with some of the people from Troy. And he goes on his adventures. And eventually, as Virgil was writing this, he was trying to give the Romans a mythology for their city Rome. And he would eventually build the city of Rome. And Virgil is a man in that story caught between two cities, the city of his birth, Troy, and the city that will be Rome. Augustine did not like the classical writers, but he liked that story. Why? Because he felt it was an analogy for everybody, where we are people caught between the two cities, the city of our birth and longing for the city that will come, heaven. And it talks about it even in Hebrews 11. Abraham went out from Ur of the Chaldees because he was looking for the city that has foundations, whose architect and builder is God. You see? So here is this kind of longing. I can put it to you a couple other ways. Let me give you a couple other illustrations. I remember when my son was young, And if there was a play at Wheaton College, the theater director would call us up and say, could Jeremy come and audition? We have a part for a child in this play. And he loved it. He would be living the life of a college student for several weeks while he was involved in rehearsals and things like this. And so he was playing the part of young Pip in the adaptation of Charles Dickens' book, Great Expectations. And he went through 2 months of rehearsals, and then he went through 2 weeks of plays every night except Sunday night, but they did a matinee on Saturday. So after 14 performances and he was done, this world that had come to mean so much to him, I have to go pick him up. Last night, he's kind of nostalgic. He changes out of his costume into his street clothes, and as we walk through the theater, for the first time in his life, he saw that the students at Wheaton College didn't leave after the last performance till they had destroyed the set. Oh, he was so brokenhearted by this. And he said, Dad, I've got to sit down. He looked like Obi-Wan Kenobi when that planet blew up, and he knew there was a disturbance in the Force, right? You guys that are Star Wars fans. And he sits there in just existential despair. Finally, after about 10, 15 minutes, I said, come on, Jeremy, we have to go. And he sees him dismantling this world. He shuffles out to the car like an old man. And he said, Dad, I just didn't want it to end. I said, I know, Jeremy, I understand. But it's the nature of every play that it has to come to an end. It's the nature of every holiday and every vacation that it has to come to an end. It's the nature of every year in school that it has to come to an end. Matter of fact, it's the nature of your childhood that it has to come to an end. Maybe you're longing for the one thing that never has to end. And he said, do you mean heaven, Dad? And I said, yeah, heaven. When you get a person who longs for that kind of thing, you go back and have reunions. I don't know how they do it in your countries, but in our country where you went to high school, they may have a reunion every 5 or 10 years. Where you went to college, they'll have a reunion every 5 or 10 years. You go back when you're my age and they give you a name tag, but the name tag has the picture from your yearbook from when you were in the college. Because if you didn't have the picture, nobody would recognize you. I go back to these things and my friends, I see them and they're all bald and fat and they wear thick glasses, they have gray hair. Life has been hard on them. I'm fine, but life has been hard on them. And finally, what happens is you go back, though, to see this world that you grew up in, and it's not the same. The old lots where you used to play baseball or play sports with your friends, soccer or something, those lots have buildings built on them. The old buildings that were landmark buildings, they've been knocked down and new buildings have been built in their place. Everything you go back to as you long to go home, it's not the same. It's not the same. What is it that we're really longing for? And how can you connect the gospel to those places? And Lewis is brilliant about talking about this kind of longing. And if you get in a conversation and you discover this kind of longing, how can you segue the gospel there? That Jesus wants to reconcile you to the Father through His death and resurrection. He exhibits His love to you. He proved His love for you while you were yet sinners. Christ died for you. And there's reconciliation and a sense of home can begin to emerge. The next one is the lover or lady. I remember when I was young, I went to school and I heard about Dante for the first time. And I was told that Dante in school met this girl, Beatrice Portinari, on the streets of Florence when he was about 9 years old. He kind of lit a candle in his heart for her. And he only saw her maybe 8-12 times in his life. He ends up marrying somebody else, having children by somebody else, but he's always carrying a candle for Beatrice Portinari. And I thought, he's a chump. Dante's a chump. I didn't like him at all. I'm pretty sure that my teacher never read him. I'm sure our teacher just gave us a summary that he had picked up somewhere. But I was prejudiced towards Dante. Then I start reading C.S. Lewis. Lewis thought he was the greatest poet ever. Lewis's friend, Charles Williams, wrote a work of literary criticism called The Figure of Beatrice. Brilliant work. And Williams was really taken by Dante. Williams talked to a friend of C.S. Lewis's and Williams named Dorothy Sayre. She was a great academic in England. And he said, you really need to read Dante. She said, I read him. Sometimes we can be inoculated against a book if we say I've read it before. That counts against ever reading it again. You know, that's terrible. And so Williams kept talking about it. So Sayre went with a schoolgirl knowledge of Williams. She read it again. And she says, oh my, that's unbelievable. She went and learned Italian so she could read it in the original. And then she started the first English translation where she maintained the three-line rhyme scheme. She died before she finished it. But here's Lewis and Williams and Dorothy Sayers. They all love Dante. And here's this incautious comment from a teacher that I had in middle school when I was young. And I prejudiced myself about Dante because of that comment. Maybe I need to go back and read him. I go back and read him. I read first the Vita Nuova, New Life. The book where Dante talks about meeting Beatrice on the streets of Florence. Oh, my heavens. He said something awakened in him. It would be like Lewis discovering the garden on the biscuit tin. You know, it was amazing to him. And so consequently, Dante doesn't understand what she means to him. And finally, 25 years after he writes the Vita Nuova, he writes a Divine Comedy. In the Divine Comedy, Dante has Virgil, who wrote the Aeneid, who represents to him the highest for Dante of literary art and beauty. Virgil becomes the one who leads him through the Inferno, leads him halfway through the Purgatorio. Beatrice, who's died, comes out of heaven and collects Dante and leads him through the rest of the Purgatorio and on into the Paradiso, into the very threshold of the vision of God himself. And what Dante is saying is these moments where we have this awakening to beauty and glory and longing in our lives, that God is wooing us. And in this case, he woos us even through these relationships, towards the archetypal relationship. It was Francis Thompson, the poet, who wrote The Hound of Heaven, who said, human love demands human meriting. Who will you find to love you, save God, really, ultimately? Because he does not love based on condition. It's powerful. I can put it to you another way. Have you ever felt lonely before in your life? What does that tell you about your nature? If you felt hungry, it tells you you need food. If you felt thirsty, it tells you you need drink. If you felt lonely, doesn't that tell you that you might be made for some other relationship? But have you ever felt lonely in a crowd? Have you ever felt lonely living under the same roof with other people you know you care for and you know they care for you? It doesn't prove anything, but might it not strongly suggest that you were made for some relationship no mere human relationship can satisfy? And this kind of longing, this lover longing here, is again something that we can connect the gospel to. And we find it in Lewis. And he's writing about this in so many of his books because it's such a strong, dominant theme. And then you've got the longing of the ascetic saint. Does anybody have any questions? Okay, the ascetic saint. Lewis hooks it into nature. He looks at somebody like Wordsworth the poet. And Wordsworth, his longing of nature, the Romantic period grew up in some ways as a reaction to the Industrial Age. They saw people leaving the farms, leaving the agrarian lifestyle, moving to the cities. The cities were, and industries were being built and getting polluted and so on. And many of the Romantic poets and so on longed for the unspoiled. Wordsworth writes a prelude and he becomes disappointed in himself. He sees as he ages, he's becoming more jaded. He's becoming more calloused. And he longs for the lost innocence of youth. He longs for some form of restoration. And so this romantic longing that looks at nature, looks at it as something that's pure and unspoiled. As Underhill writes about it, she writes about it as the ascetic saint. The person who comes to the place of realizing they're broken. And then in the realization of one's brokenness, longs to have it fixed. And to become more saint-like rather than more broken. This is a very interesting one, and I think I can develop it this way. I remember years ago I was asked to speak at Hartford College at Oxford University to speak in their Evensong service. And after the service was over, the chaplain there is a friend of mine, Michael Chantry, asked me if I would have dinner with the faculty at High Table. High Table is something else at Oxford University. Didn't you see any of the Harry Potter movies? You know the dining hall where the owls are flying in and flying out? That's a real place. That's the hall at Christ Church at Oxford. And it's the most spectacular of all the halls. But Hartford is not quite as big. It's not quite as spectacular, but it's pretty remarkable. You have these honey-colored stone walls that are wood-paneled, and they have famous benefactors and graduates of that college. John Donne, the poet, went there. William Tyndale, the Bible translator, attended there. You see these paintings of these different people hanging on the walls, looking down at the students while they're eating. There are long tables that run the length of the hall. Above the tables in the back where you enter, there's a balcony where a string quartet or quintet can be playing while you eat. The long tables are where the students sit. Perpendicular to them at this end of the hall is a table where the faculty sit. If the students are eating roast beef, the faculty are eating prime rib. If the students are eating steak, the faculty are eating filet mignon. Everybody comes dressed in their academic gowns. The meal begins with a Latin prayer. The wine flows freely, and you could cut the pretense with a knife. It's not so bad if you don't take yourself too seriously, but unfortunately in that environment, there are a lot of people tempted to take themselves way too seriously. So the chaplain introduces me as having just preached in the evensong service. The Latin prayer, I sit down. The woman sitting across me taught history there. And so she looks at me after we sit down, first thing in the meal, and she says, "So Jerry, why are you a Christian?" And I think she's asking because she wants to know about Jesus. But somebody told me afterwards they thought she asked because she wanted to make me the entertainment at that night's dinner. So I answered her as honestly as I can. I said, I'm a Christian because I'm aware of deficiency in my life and failure in my life. I'm not aware of all of it, but I'm aware of enough of it to be devastated. I'm aware of the incongruities of what the Bible calls sin. I believe in the high ideal of love, but I've had sharp words with the people I say I love most in the world. I believe in justice, but there have been times I've been unfair in my treatment of others. I didn't set out to be unfair, but I realize in retrospect I've been unfair. And I said, I don't think I could make it in life if I didn't know there was a thing called forgiveness and a love of God that would nurture me and help me to grow and get better, because I want to get better. Well, she was taken back by that answer. It wasn't what she was expecting. I think she was expecting something more theological or philosophical. She said, "Well, I can appreciate that, but that's just not my issue." I said, "I think I understand what you're saying." I said, I became a Christian when I was a freshman in college, and I certainly didn't become perfect overnight. That took 2 or 3 weeks before that happened. And the whole faculty did what you did. They just all laughed, roaring laughter. And I looked at her and I said, "Your laughter just betrayed you." She said, "What do you mean?" I said, "Well, you and I just met, so you don't know the specifics of my life that made that statement nonsense. But you knew it was nonsensical. So either your read of history or your read of your own life shows you nobody's got it together." She said, "You got me." I said, "Then knowing about your own struggles, what helps you? How do you get by?" She says, "I have faith in humanity." I said, "I'm interested in anything that's going to help me, but let me ask you about your faith in humanity. Have you ever wounded another human being before?" I said, "Have you ever been wounded by another human being before?" She said, "Of course." I said, "Have you ever wounded another human being before?" She said, "I suppose so." She was a little softer on herself. I said, "So how does this faith work in humanity when you've been wounded by others and you've wounded others?" And just then the man sitting next to her taught French. I says, "How does it work for Christians?" And we spent the rest of the meal talking about the love of God and the forgiveness of God and the mercy of God. These deep longings, as we engage in evangelism, telling others about Jesus, if we get to the passion of Lewis, "Woe to you if you do not evangelize." And if we own this as a value, and we enter into relationship with people and we start talking to them about these things, as we get to this level of depth, it's easy to segue the gospel to these places. If there's these, there could be way more. I remember when 9/11 hit in America, we were devastated by that. And I remember You know, Todd Beamer, the guy, I don't know if you remember Flight 93, where they fought against the terrorists and that flight crashed in Pennsylvania. That young man, Todd Beamer, who said, let's roll, he used to come to my house for Bible study. I knew him. I knew his wife. She was a kid in my youth group years ago. And I thought to myself, this guy was just getting up to go to work. How can we be safe in this world? And I thought, why would we expect to be safe? And what is it about us that longs for ultimate safety? Is that not a heaven kind of longing? You know, I thought to myself that day, what will this come to mean for us? We're still trying to figure that out. But why is it that we want to make sense of our experience? What does that tell us about? If life is a crock, if it's all nonsense, why do we want to make sense of our experience? And another one Lewis says too is, notice how we're perpetually surprised at time. Fancy John being grown up and married. I can hardly believe it. And Lewis says, in heaven's name, why? Do fish complain of the sea for being wet? If they did, would that fact not strongly suggest that they had not always been or would not always be purely aquatic creatures? Isn't our being surprised at time, Lewis says, a suggestion to us that we're not merely temporal creatures? And are there ways I could connect the gospel to this? And I think these things that Lewis has said have great relevance for us today as we engage with people in our one of the things that I think is really important with Lewis is that he sees that there are some things that cannot be reduced to mere formula. He's very good in Christian apologetics. He's very good in propositional arguments and so on. His logic is excellent. And his ability to write in a memorable way, whereby he also uses interesting word pictures and depiction, is helpful for us. And I think there's much we could learn from him. And even in our in any kind of proclamation that we engage in, I'm not trying to say in any way that Lewis is flawless, and I don't always agree with everything he says. For example, he says in Mere Christianity that he thinks pride is the great sin. He's not the only one who said that. Augustine, in his exposition of Psalm 19, says that he also thinks that pride is the great sin. So if I'm disagreeing with Lewis and Augustine, I'm probably wrong. I admit that. But let me see if I can tease it out a little bit and show you what I'm talking about. When Lewis and Augustine talk about pride, they talk about pride as if it's sort of the mainspring from which all other sins are generated and around which they constellate. And I disagree with them. If they would have said they thought pride was the apex of a process, it was the zenith of man's hostility towards God, an expression of his anger towards God, I would be more in line with them. But I would like to suggest to you that pride could be considered the great sin, unlike Augustine and Lewis consider it, if you consider it as something like the apex of a pyramid. Now, we would say the apex of the pyramid is the greatest point on the pyramid, but certainly that which is beneath the apex is far more substantive, you see. So if pride, and I'm not talking about pride of a job well done or pride you take in your children when they do well. I'm talking about that form of pride that exhibits itself in some form of pretense, makes itself look better than it really is. What precedes that pride? When you find yourself in any way suggesting to others or putting on airs to others that you're better than you really are, what's going on inside? What precedes it? There's an unsatisfaction, to be sure, that we do know there's a deficiency, right? And so we don't want others to know about it. What are we masking at that point?
Hurt.
Could be hurt. You know, maybe the hurt that we're not good enough, and we don't want others to know it, right? Huh?
Shame.
Shame? There's a shame to it. Maybe fear. or insecurity. You know, I could be shamed because I'm not secure. I didn't know enough and I feel bad, so I want to make it look better than it is. Could be hurt. But these things are sort of synonymous, insecurity, fear, and so on. If that's true, then the scriptures are explicit what might be at the base. In 1 John 4:18, it says, perfect love casts out fear. If perfect love casts out fear, the corollary would be that imperfect love breeds anxiety. You and I have never been loved perfectly by another human being before. So consequently, every one of us at some level is saddled with the burden of anxiety. It gets worse before it gets better. You and I have never loved anybody perfectly either. So the people who have looked to us, though we've done as best we might, they are saddled with the burden of anxiety because we couldn't love them perfectly. There's only one person who knows us utterly, knows all about us, and loves us entirely, and loves us without condition. God's love is ontological. The Bible says God is love. It's characteristic of his life. God is love. His love isn't based on condition. I would suggest to you the base of the pyramid, the great sin, is neglect of God's love or rejection of God's love. So how do you get through to a person this message if we've lived our lives in some way rejecting his love? George MacDonald, this author who influenced Lewis, he once wrote, "We do not have souls. We are souls. We have bodies." If you tell a child he has a soul, the child thinks, like anything else he has, his keys, his book, his coat, that he could lose it and he goes on someplace else. If he has a soul, he thinks that when he dies, he goes to the grave and his soul goes off someplace else. But MacDonald says, no, tell the child he is a soul and he has a body. And when he dies, he goes to heaven and leaves the body behind like clipped hair on a barbershop floor. This is significant, I think. So consequently, Lewis says that if we engage in what he calls a continued disobedience to conscience, when we violate reason, and when we violate conscience, we have trouble. And how do you break through to that person's consciousness with the message of the gospel? I don't know exactly what the soul is. I can make arguments for the soul. I think I could set forth some pretty strong arguments for the existence of the soul. But traditionally, we have said that the soul includes a choosing part, the will, a reasoning part, the mind or the intellect, and a feeling part, the emotion. So volition, reason, and emotion. I would suggest to you, even coming from an academic environment, that the reason is by far the weakest of these three. By far the weakest. If I make a bad choice, my reason doesn't kick in and say, boy, Jerry, that was stupid. You're just going to hurt yourself and hurt others if you continue down that path. No, my reason being weak is marshaled by my will to make all kinds of rationalizations and excuses for that bad choice. C.S. Lewis says, the reason stands like sentries, dragon sentries before my heart, making sure that only what it wants will pass through, but nothing that will make me have to see it as it is rather than how I want it to be. If I'm hurt emotionally, does my reason kick in and say, boy, Jerry, you need to grieve that hurt and forgive that person that hurt you, lest that begins to corrode your soul? Anne Lamott said in her book, Traveling Mercies, bitterness, which grows as a result of lack of forgiveness, bitterness is like you drinking the rat poison and then waiting for the rat to die. It's a horrifying image, isn't it? So how do you get past the watchful dragons, Lewis asks. And basically, he says, a person will put up all kinds of arguments because they're already used to rationalizing things. But if you want to get past the watchful dragons, you need to use story. We have an example of it in the scriptures. Nathan the prophet gets the assignment. from God. You need to go tell David he sinned. Now this is David who not only sinned egregiously and abused his power as king by committing adultery with one of his best friends and one of his military top officials' wife, but he covers up the sin by having the official and the soldier murdered. And it looks like David's getting away with it, and now Nathan gets word from God, you need to go tell David he didn't do well. I don't know about you, but I'd be nervous about that assignment if he's already put one guy away. So what does Nathan do? He goes to David and he tells a story about a very wealthy man who had a lot of animals. And there was this poor family, and they were raising their 4-H club, their junior farmers club lamb, you know, for their county fair or something like that. This lamb was part of their family. It was it sat at their table when they ate. It was a pet. And rather than the rich man killing one of his own lambs, he went when somebody was visiting him and killed this family's lamb, sacrificed it and ate it. And David comes out of his seat. And he says, that man has to pay, and that man has to pay fourfold. And Nathan, after now knowing that the story has gotten past the watchful dragons, as Lewis calls it, he says, David, you're the guy. You're the guy. And Lewis recognized that story is a very important tool in the rhetorical toolkit. It allows us to penetrate the conscience and allows us to get a word to a person in a way that we might not do any other way. How many of you have ever been to a movie and you've surrendered to the story in the film, and the next thing you knew, you were weeping in the movie? What was it about the story, and to what depths did it pierce that it got to you like that? Now, when Lewis and his good friend J.R.R. Tolkien would talk about these things and write about these things, Lewis published a book called Essays Presented to Charles Williams. And he wrote about Williams. He included an essay, but also Tolkien included an essay in this thing on fairy stories. Lewis wrote about fairy stories. They collaborated about fairy stories, talked about it, and so on. And what are the elements in story that they saw so important? And I would suggest to you that there's basically five elements in the stories as Tolkien writes about them. First off, he says there is the issue of prohibition. But all the stories, when they're told, they have a kind of tension to them. And this tension allows us to see where the boundaries are and where the boundaries are that are violated. Tolkien refers to Chesterton. I want to read you what Chesterton wrote about this. He says, if you really read the fairy tales, you'll observe that one idea runs from one end of them to the other. The idea that peace and happiness can only exist on some condition. This idea, which is the core of ethics, is the core of the nursery tales. The whole happiness of fairyland hangs upon a thread, upon one thread. Cinderella may have a dress woven on supernatural looms and blazing with unearthly brilliance, but she must be back when the clock strikes 12. Do you know that fairy story? The king may invite fairies to the christening, but he must invite all the fairies, or frightful results will follow. Bluebeard's wife may open all doors but one. Promise is broken to a cat and the whole world goes wrong. A promise is broken to a yellow dwarf and the whole world goes wrong. A girl may be the bride of the god of love himself if she never tries to see him. She sees him and he vanishes away. Do you know that one? Cupid and Psyche. And that's the one that Lewis writes the novel Till We Have Faces about. A girl is given a box on condition she does not open it. She opens it and all the evils of this world rush out at her. Pandora's box. A man and a woman are put in a garden on condition they do not eat one fruit. They eat it and lose their joy in all the fruits of the earth. You see how he segues now into a movement of story, into a movement of a story that we believe is at the core of our fallenness. This great idea, then, is the backbone of all folklore, the idea that all happiness hangs on one thin veto. All positive joy depends on one negative. Now, it is obvious that there are many philosophical and religious ideas akin to or symbolized by this, but it is not with them I wish to deal here. It is surely obvious that all ethics ought to be taught to this fairy tale tune, that if one does a thing forbidden, one imperils all the things provided. A man who breaks his promise to his wife ought to be reminded that, even if she's a cat, the case of the fairy cat shows that such cautious conduct may be incautious. A burglar just about to open someone else's safe should be playfully reminded that he is in the perilous posture of the beautiful Pandora. He's about to lift the forbidden lid and loosen evils unknown. By the way, what was left in the box after it was open? She opens a box. It's like the fall. It's parallel to the fall. Pandora's box.
Was it hope?
Hope. Hope was left in the box. The boy eating someone's apples and someone's apple tree should be a reminder that he has come to a mystical moment of his life when one apple may rob him of all the others. This is the profound morality of fairy tales, which so far from being lawless, goes to the root of all law. Instead of finding, like common books of ethics, a rationalistic basis for each commandment, they find the great mystical basis for all commandments. We are in this fairyland on sufferance. It is not for us to quarrel with the conditions under which we enjoy this wild vision of the world. The vetoes are indeed extraordinary, but then so are the concessions. The idea of property, the idea of someone else's apples is a rum idea. But then the idea of there being any apples is a rum idea. It is strange and weird that I cannot with safety drink 10 bottles of champagne. But then the champagne itself is strange and weird if you come to that. If I have drunk of the fairy's drink, it is but just I should drink by the fairy's rules. We may not see the direct logical connection between three beautiful silver spoons and a large ugly policeman. But then who in fairy tales could ever see the direct logical connection between three bears and a giant, or between a rose and a roaring beast? Not only can these fairy tales be enjoyed because they are moral, but morality can be enjoyed because it puts us in a fairyland, in a world at once of wonder and of war. Where I grew up in Los Angeles, there was a playground at the Baptist church. There was no ground for them to play on the church ground at the elementary school that was at the church. What they had to do, because everything was built on, they made a playground on the roof of a three-story building. And you can imagine if they would let the kids go up and play on the roof of that building and they didn't have any fencing. The kids would have all huddled together if the teacher would have left them on the playground, except a few third grade boys who would have tempted, danger by walking along the edge. But they built this 12-foot high fence. And the 12-foot high fence, you could see as you walk by down below, balls bouncing against the fence and back onto the playground, or kids grabbing hold of the fence when they finished a relay race or something like that. Now, there could have been some child on that playground pushing his nose up against the fence, bemoaning the fact that he couldn't get outside. But the fence was protecting him from certain peril. And what he needed to do was to turn his back on the fence and see how the fence defined for him a playground. And the restrictions that we find in the fairy story are trying to show us that the perimeters are only defining for us the playground. And they're keeping us from danger. And we learn that art in the story. And as Chesterton says, it teaches us the ethics of all stories. But then the next thing is what Tolkien calls fantasy. Did I not spell that right? Fantasy? Did I spell it right? Fantasy. And fantasy is the awakening of desire. The awakening of desire, ultimately, Lewis says, for other worlds. Okay, he writes a book called Of Other Worlds. Lewis does. And the awakening of desire is something you'll see particularly at the end of the Voyage of the Dawn Treader, where they've had these great adventures in this story. I'll look at some of those adventures along the way. But Lucy, this very spiritually sensitive young girl, she has seen at the end of Prince Caspian that her older brother Peter and her older sister Susan were not allowed back into Narnia. And Lucy suspects that this day might be coming for her as well. And sure enough, at the end of that book, as she's saying goodbye to Aslan, the Christ figure, the lion of that land, Aslan tells her what she didn't want to hear. You won't be coming back into my world, Lucy. You're growing older, and you must need to grow. You need to grow into your world and be the person you're to be in that world. And she weeps and weeps and weeps, and she says, Aslan, it's not Narnia, you know. It's you. How shall I go on knowing that I can't meet you again? And he says, oh, Lucy, I live in your world too. And she's completely surprised. And he says, you have been brought here for a time that knowing me here, you might know me better there. And Lewis is writing this, and it awakens in us this longing, you see, the very kind of longing that we were talking about in the other talk about evangelism. And I think Lewis sees that story sometimes can do this even better than any kind of propositional presentation. Lewis isn't opposed to propositions, but he recognizes that they have their limits, just as story has their limits. I wouldn't want to in any way suggest that story works for all things. If I'm an astronaut on my way to the moon, I don't want the physicists who are setting the trajectory for that rocket ship to be sitting around telling, you know, Goldilocks and the Three Bears to each other. I want a little more robust and sensitive approach to these things. Stories have their limits too. But the deal is, I think sometimes we think the propositions are going to do it all for us, but the story gets past the watchful dragon. So the awakening of desire is the next big area. But then Tolkien talks about another form of the fairy story, another feature, I would say, and that is what he calls recovery. Recovery. And this is helping us to regain a clear view of things. We can, by virtue of familiarity, trivialize a thing. When I was a boy, I can remember my parents at Christmas time. They would let us open our presents, and then when it came time to go to bed, you didn't want to go to bed and part with the present. And they would let us take one present to bed with us each night at Christmas. And so we'd take the present to bed. We opened it Christmas morning, and we were inseparable from it. Took it to bed that night. The next day, we played with it again. Took it to bed that night, too. The next day, we played with it some. We didn't take it to bed that night. The next day, we played with it a little. And the next day, it ended up in the toy box, and once in a blue moon, we might get it out. We do this with our relationships as well. And Tolkien says recovery and story helps us to see things anew, afresh. That which has been trashed by trivialization, it awakens in us. The wood behind our house that's become familiar to us now becomes re-enchanted because we have discovered the enchanted wood in the story. Lewis even talks about, in an essay he writes called... talking about bicycles, he talks about phases of enchantment. He says the first is to be unenchanted. We don't see beauty. We don't see glory. We don't feel the tug of God on our heart. But then something happens. The biscuit tin in the garden, the meeting Beatrice on the streets of Florence. Something happens in us, and our heart is awakened, and we become enchanted. And we tether our heart to that particular thing, thinking that thing will awaken us and fulfill us. And then all of a sudden in time, familiarity trivializes and we untether. It doesn't fulfill us. Our expectations crash. And the third phase of enchantment is to be unenchanted. Unenchanted, enchanted, and then to be disenchanted. Disenchanted. And then finally, we go through that cycle. Lewis calls it the dialectic of desire. We tether our heart to something that doesn't fulfill, we're disappointed. We tether our heart to something else, doesn't fulfill, we're disappointed. We tether our heart to something else, doesn't fulfill, we're disappointed. Lewis says in Mere Christianity, if I discover in myself a longing that nothing in this world can satisfy, it doesn't mean that the world's a fraud. Maybe the world was only made to awaken desire. But ultimately, if I can't find the fulfillment in this world, maybe the fulfillment will be found in the next. So that's the idea behind this. So recovery. So recovery, here's some examples of it. George MacDonald, this author who influenced Lewis, He wrote a story called The Princess and the Goblin. And when it was originally published, there were so many Christian elements in this story, but when it was originally published, they're there. Later editions edited out the Christian elements. But in the original edition, the author starts to tell the story, and he's interrupted by an outside voice. So here's how it starts. There once was a little princess who... Oh, but Mr. Editor, why do you always write about princesses? Well, because every little girl is a princess. Oh, you'll make them vain if you tell them that. Not if they understand what I mean. Well, then what do you mean by a princess? Well, what do you mean by a princess? Well, when I say princess, I mean the daughter of a king. Very well, then. Every little girl is a princess. And there'd be no need to say anything about it except that she's always in danger of forgetting her rank and behaving as if she had grown out of the mud. Every little girl is a princess. That's recovery. That's seeing things with a clear view. G.K. Chesterton's poem, The Donkey, is another example of recovery. He just puts the name Donkey in the title, but we don't hear Donkey in the poem. But see if you don't get some sense of recovery from this poem. When fishes flew and forests walked, and figs grew upon thorn, some moment when the moon was blood, then surely I was born. With monstrous head and sickening cry, and ears like errant wings, the devil's walking parody on all four-footed things. The tattered outlaw of the earth, of ancient crooked will, starve, scourge, deride me, I'm dumb, I keep my secret still. Fools, for I also had my hour, one far fierce hour and sweet. There was a shout about my ears and palms before my feet. And all of a sudden we see this donkey. I used to raise donkeys. You see them as these sort of crazy animals, crazy beasts. But in fact, we have to always remember there was a time when Jesus chose to ride into Jerusalem on the donkey, and the donkey's recovered for us. See? So the story, ultimately the recovery that they want to have is that we would never look on people the same. This is, again, in line with Lewis's, there are no ordinary people. You've never met a mere mortal. And the story helps us to see it again. The next one is escape. Escape. An escape is for Tolkien, as he writes about it. Lewis writes elegantly about it in his Of Other Worlds. I don't have time to read the whole account from Lewis. But as Tolkien writes about it, he says, there are some people who look at stories for children and they look at them as psychological escape. Tolkien says, I'm not talking about psychological escape from the problems of the real world. I'm talking about escaping from the materialistic world view that keeps pounding on people in the secular world. And they escape in such a way that he says it's not the escape of the deserter, it's the escape of the prisoner. And to understand it that way. So in Lewis's Voyage of the Dawn Treader, you have this place where Lucy and those on the Dawn Treader, Prince Caspian, Edmund, Eustace, and so on, they come to this island, and it's an island where they hear voices, but they don't see anybody. And the people on the island seem confused, but they're invisible. They have spears. Because they're invisible, they don't know how many of them there are. There could be thousands. They're worried about them. But they seem confused and odd. They call themselves duffelpuds. They're really monopods, but they can't even get their own identity straight. In some ways, they're parodies on we humans, these duffelpuds. But they want to be made visible, and they say the magician of that island has made them invisible. And they want to be visible once again. And the only way they could be visible is if a little girl goes into the magician's house and goes up to the library on the second floor and reads a spell to make one visible that's in this magician's book. And so Lucy is the one that's chosen, and it's kind of nerve-wracking if people are invisible and she has to go into this house and it's somebody else's house and he has powers, you know. Will she get herself in big trouble? She goes in the house. It's a massive house, and it's got a glorious staircase that winds up to the second floor. She goes up the second floor, and there's the library there, and she has to go into the library, and this book is a massive book, and it's on this table, but to climb up on this ladder to get to it even, she's a bit nervous because she has her back to the door. And she tries to open the book, and she can't open it. And then she realizes it's clasped shut like a big medieval book. So she opens the clasp, and she opens the book, huge book. And she touches the pages, and her fingers tingle. And the book had a nice smell about it. And the printing was thick downstrokes and thin upstrokes of calligraphy. And she noticed in the margins there was illumination. And there were stories, and she could see that the stories were animated, and they moved in a way that was coherent with whatever the book was writing about. And these voices didn't know where to start. She couldn't just go to the spell. She had to start from the beginning and go through. And as she was turning the pages, she saw spells for how to call up bad weather, spells for how to calm the weather. She saw spells for how to remove warts and spells for how to gather bees. And when she looks at the spell for how to gather bees, she sees this man who's gathering a hive of bees. She sees spells for how to make a person have a head of a donkey like they did to Bottom in Shakespeare's Midsummer Night's Dream. And finally, she comes to a spell to make one more beautiful than the lot of mortals. And Lucy was always the one that people looked past because Susan, her older sister, was the one that was more attractive. She thought, I would like to say this spell. And she looks in the margin and she sees a little girl like herself standing at a big book. And she sees a little girl saying the spell. And all of a sudden she sees people standing around a girl on the margin who looks like her sister Susan. And now all the people aren't paying attention to Susan anymore. They're coming in and paying attention to the girl who looks like Lucy Beautified. And all of a sudden she sees wars breaking out for her honor and people launching ships and like Helen of Troy. She's so excited. She says, I've got to say this spell. And just then Oslaught jumps out of the page. And she turns the page real quick. And she sees another spell, how to listen into what your friends say about you when you're not listening. And you know how it is sometimes, where maybe we triumph over some bit of temptation. And then when we get over this big barrier, a little thing comes up and we decide we'll delight ourselves with this one because we kind of deserve it since we accomplished this one good thing. And so she reads a spell to how to listen in to her friends. See what they're saying when she's not there. And she sees one of her friends, her dear friends, goaded by her arch enemy at school, getting her to say some nasty thing about her. And Lucy hears it and her heart is broken and she just cries and cries and cries. She turns on to the next page, and it's a page that tells a spell for the refreshment of the spirit. And as she reads this spell, she finds that it goes on for 3 pages. And as she comes to the end of the spell, she says, that was the greatest story I've ever heard. I must read it again. But as she goes to read it again, she finds in this book you can only go forward from that spell. You can't go back. And the words start to disappear. And she says, this is a strange book. And she says, I must remember the story. And she says, oh yeah, it was about a green hill and a cup and a sword and a tree. And from that day forward, Lucy always said, whatever she thought of a good story, it was a story that reminded her of the story in the magician's book. She finally comes to the spell to make things visible. And she utters it, and Aslan appears suddenly. She says, Aslan, how did you get here? He said, oh dear heart, I've been here all along. Your words made me visible. She says, how could I make you visible? Don't you think I would abide by my own rules? He says, Lucy, you've been listening in where you shouldn't listen in. Oh, Aslan, I'm so sorry. Will it ever be better again? So the person isn't told what it might have been. And he licks her and he breathes on her, restores her, so to speak. And he says, come, we must meet the owner of this house. And she says to him, Aslam, will you tell me the story that I read? The one, the spell for the refreshment of the spirit? Oh, do. I've never heard such a story like that. And he says, I will tell you, dear heart. That's one story I will tell you over and over and over again. What story was it? It was a gospel story. It was about a hill, Calvary, a tree, the cross, the sword, the death that he died, the cup that he drank. And the thing is, Lewis, as he tells us that, recovers for us in some senses even our own dignity in the telling of the story. By the way, it's a story we'll want to hear over and over again. There's a guy in America, he makes movies, and he doesn't like Christians. And he's very, very active in saying he doesn't like Christians. And his name's James Cameron, one of the biggest movie makers of all time. He did the movie with Arnold Schwarzenegger, the Terminator. When he does Terminator 2, what does he do? Schwarzenegger comes from a different world and dies to save this woman and her son. He makes a Titanic. He's going to make the most expensive movie ever made, $200 million. He better have great special effects, so he builds a set that's a quarter the size of the original Titanic. He better have great music. He gets Celine Dion in her ascendancy. He better have great box office draw. He gets Leonardo DiCaprio and Kate Winslet. But he also better tell a great story. So what story does he get? He doesn't like Christians, but he borrows our story. Jack wins the ticket to the doomed ship. He goes to the bow of the ship and he makes the form of the cross and says, I'm king of the world. There's a woman who's stuck in circumstances not of her own making. Her mother, her father has died. Her mother wants a meal ticket. She's going to marry her off to a jerk. She can't get out of this circumstance on her own. She goes to try and kill herself, and Jack saves her life. They bring the old lady when they discover the Titanic, who's still living because they want to hear her story. And she tells them the story of that night. And they say, we don't even have a record of his name on the book. Isn't that funny? You don't have a record of him, and yet he saved me in every way. And after he saves her, just as he almost magically ended up on the ship, he disappears as well. Cameron hates Christians, but he knows there's a story people always gravitate towards. And there's recovery for you, an escape. We're escaping from this world into the world where we're reminded of the great story. And then what does he do with his next film? He makes Avatar. Here's a guy who ends up in that world and saves that world. But he is embodied in one of the bodies of the people of that world. Cameron keeps using our story. We're ashamed of the story. We don't tell it. Lewis is telling it over and over again in his fiction because he knows it gets past watchful dragons. And what's the name of the Avatar? What does it mean in Sanskrit? Do you know? Incarnation. He knew deliberately what he was doing. It's a great story.
It's a great. He was doing this on purpose.
Absolutely. When you spend $200 million to make a movie, every scene is on purpose. He knew exactly what he was doing. Now, the question is he intrigued by the story, or does he hate Christians but still uses their story because he knows it's a story everybody likes and it'll still make him money? I don't know if he's doing it in a utilitarian way or if he's fascinated by the story. He seems obsessed with the story, actually, if you look at the movies he makes. But he's very vocal about his not liking Christians. It's interesting. The last thing is what he calls consolation or eucatastrophe. The catastrophe that comes about to the good end. Tolkien says it's the gospel story in his epilogue to this essay. He says, I am a Christian, so what I write is written with that Christian point of view. The eucatastrophe, the consolation, the happy ending of this story echoes what's reverberating through history. The happy ending, the happy story. I don't know about you guys. I talk to my American friends and they think the whole world's going to hell in a handbasket. I say, really, why? They recount all these bad things that are happening in the world. I say, well, I don't know if it's the end. I don't know if Jesus is coming back or not. I hope he comes back before this conversation's over. But throughout history, read it. Every time it gets dark, what happens? There's some sort of reformation or revival. If Jesus comes back, that's the greatest eucatastrophe. Tolkien says the eucatastrophe to the fall is the cross. The eucatastrophe to the cross is the resurrection. The eucatastrophe to human history is consummation. And so we start the third book of the Voyage of the third book of the Narnian Chronicles. Voyage of the Dawn Treader. How does it begin? There once was a boy named Eustace Clarence Scrub, and he almost deserved it. That's written by Clive Staples Lewis, who knew that no child deserved to be named Clive Staples Lewis. But Eustace Clarence Scrub is the archetypal brat. He has the heart of a dragon under the skin of a little boy. And he ends up in Narnia with his cousins, Edmund, and his cousin, Lucy. And in that land, he makes life miserable for everybody. He's on this ship. They're trying to take Reepicheep to Aslan's country. They're trying to find out what happened to the seven lost lords of Narnia. They go through a horrible storm, and the ship ends up beached on this island. And again, Eustace has caused trouble for everybody. They've got to fix the ship. They've lost the mast. They've got to revictual the ship. And rather than doing work, Eustace goes wandering off. And in the magic of that world, he ends up becoming externally what he's always been internally. And Eustace is turned into a dragon. Oh, he makes his way back to the ship. They're all afraid of him at first, but awkwardly he scratches his name in the sand. And they see that it's Eustace. And even in his uglier state, you know, he had to look in the pond and see the truth that he was a dragon. And he realized he had been a dragon all along. And they love on him. And he ends up able to help them with the ship. They need a mast. He goes and knocks down a big tree with his claws. He knocks off all the branches with his hot breath. He tempers the wood. With his strength, he puts it in place on the ship. He flies around the island and he gathers up a bunch of goats and wild animals to revictual the ship. He flies around the island. He tells them where there's sweet water so they could fill the cistern on the ship. And finally, it's time for them to leave. And what are they going to do about Eustace? That night they all sleep and Eustace goes back to his dragon lair. Eventually when he would tell the story, he said that while he was back there, a lion showed up. He was bigger than the lion, but he was afraid of this lion. And the lion said to him, "You must undress yourself." And Eustace said that it dawned on him that dragons were scaly things like lizards and snakes. Maybe he could just shed his skin. And so, tremendous effort. He sheds his skin. He looks in the pond. Still, he's a dragon. Again, he tries to shed his skin. He sheds it. He looks in the pond. Still, he's a dragon. A third time, frustrated, he looks in the pond. Still, he's a dragon. And he said, the lion said to him, "I must undress you." And frustrated, he surrenders to that dragon, or that lion claw that goes all the way through that dragon flesh and touches that dragon heart and makes him boy again. And when he goes back to the voyage, to the Dawn Treader, when he goes back in those gray dawn moments, there's only one person from the Dawn Treader who's awake to receive him to be his father confessor. Who is it? It's Edmund, the brother who had betrayed all of his siblings to the White Witch, and Aslan had given his life to save him. And he becomes the one who in empathy can be the father confessor. There's consolation, the happy ending of two stories. Not only is Edmund seeing that he has a role to play in restoration of others, but also Eustace is restored. And Eustace ends up becoming the restorer when he goes back in the silver chair. It's very interesting, isn't it? So Lewis is using these stories in ways, not manipulatively, but using them in ways that he could get past watchful dragons and that people could hear what they might not hear otherwise. It's always part of his rhetorical toolbook. His first book he writes after he becomes a Christian is a book in Christian apologetics. It's called The Pilgrim's Regress, an allegorical apology for Christianity, Reason, and Romanticism. His first book. He writes Out of the Silent Planet, and he says, I've realized any amount of theology can now be smuggled into people's minds under the guise of romance. He writes his popular apologetics, Problem of Pain, Miracles, Mere Christianity. But he's always using story all the way through. He says, the imaginative man in me is older and more continually operating than the rational man. So anyway, any questions or comments about this? Is this helpful at all? Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you.